Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Be revolutionary. UMass is the Commonwealth's flagship public research university and committed to the relentless pursuit of progress. Learn more at umass.edu.
I'm Jim Browdy, head of Boston Public Radio. We're live at the Boston Public Library today, opening the show with you. Lawyers representing President Biden have returned classified documents he retained in a think tank office from his time as VP. In response, Trump is suggesting the FBI search the White House. We'll open phone and text line to hear your thoughts on whether Biden deserves the same scrutiny his predecessor is facing, or does it even matter?
I'm Marjorie Egan. Then it's NBC Sports Boston's Trini Casey with reflections on the Patriots' lost season and what's next for Coach Belichick. We'll also talk about Naomi Osaka dropping out of the Australian Open and a hilarious story out of Texas Christian University where the football team recruited help from the all-powerful Hypnotoad to advance in the college football playoffs. All that to come on Boston Public Radio 89.7 GBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live as we do every Tuesday and every Friday from the Boston Public Library, and we are streaming on youtube.com/GBH News. Hello, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. And Friday, as we said, we will not be here at the library. We're broadcasting live from the Embrace unveiling on Boston Common, 11 to 1. Then we will carry the ceremony live at 1 o'clock till its conclusion on 89.7 GBH. Here at the library, though, there will be a listening and watch party for our show and the ceremony. No tickets or RSVP needed. I assume everybody knows the Embrace is the memorial to the kings and to 60 to 70 civil rights leaders, some of whom we know, some of whom we will get to know from Boston decades ago. So the White House, as you know, has come forward with news that a, quote, small number of classified documents were found in Joe Biden's private office at a Washington think tank last fall from his time when he was vice president. The documents were found on November 2nd in the run-up to the midterm elections, but only disclosed yesterday. We want to know, what do you make of the news? The number is 877-301-8970 to call or text. The Justice Department is investigating. It appears that the situation with Biden's documents is very different from Trump's classified document debacle at Mar-a-Lago. But even if it is false equivalency, will that matter? It appears to me that the AG, Merrick Garland's job, has just been made a hell of a lot harder in terms of the Mar-a-Lago case and this case. The number is 877-301-8970. I was thinking of you a lot when I was watching this last night. If this debate was in a classroom at the
right.
Kennedy School of Government,
right.
I think most people would say it was voluntary disclosure by Joe Biden as opposed to the obstruction of the former president. It's not my phone. It's probably yours.
Yeah, I can't find
She can't
phone.
Find her phone. See, that's one of the problems is when your phone goes off during a live show, that's not that much of a problem if you know where your phone is.
Oh,
if you don't know where your phone is,
Jamie
by the way,
found the phone.
Yeah. So let me just be clear. Jamie, our colleague found your
found
phone.
Found the phone. Thank you, Jamie.
As I was saying, if this was a debate at the Kennedy School of Government or anywhere, Liberty University or whatever it's called, I think most objective people would say Trump needed subpoenas. He obstructed. He essentially asked his lawyers to lie about all documents being disgorged.
Yep.
Here was voluntarily disclosed. I have to say it doesn't matter. There's a great line from Dana Bash yesterday on CNN last night. She said a famous line in politics is, if you're explaining, you're losing. And I think for the vast majority of American people, when they read Trump's social media post last night, when is the FBI going to raid the many houses of Joe Biden, maybe even the White House? I think the average fair-minded, busy person is probably going to say, Marjorie, I know you're not going to like this. Wait a second. They're both taking classified documents, even if it is apples and oranges. I think this is really, really, really complicates the Attorney General's job in terms of possible criminal prosecution of Donald Trump.
Well, it does. It does make the Department of Justice situation even more difficult. I do like the fact that Merrick Garland has appointed a Trump appointee to look into the situation. I think that's a good thing to make it look a little bit less partisan. But you're right. I mean, there are a lot of questions here. If the documents were discovered in November 2nd, which everyone agrees that they were, why are we just hearing about this in January? Why didn't President Biden talk about this earlier?
Right. The election was not for 6 days. What do you think the answer to that question is, Marjorie? It would hurt the Democrats in the midterms.
It would hurt the Democrats in the midterms. When did he find out about this? Again, you know, the timeline is his lawyers found these things in a locked closet on November 2nd. They immediately called the National Archives the next day. On November 3rd, the people from the archives came and got the documents. But still, you're right. It muddies the waters. It makes it more difficult. I guess a great question people have is Trump, you know, the man with 9 lives or 12 lives or 15 lives, ever going to get held accountable for what he's done? It does seem that his popularity and power is waning, and it does seem that there are other investigations like the Georgia investigation into asking for the 11,000 lost votes is still out there. So is Letitia James' investigation into his business practices. And we had the January 6th hearings.
And the January 6th investigation, the insurrection investigation of Jack Smith, right?
Yes.
The special counsel.
And he's
also
Mar-a-Lago.
He is also Mar-a-Lago.
Yeah, he's both those things. So, you know, it seems to me all these things together are going to hurt the president, but is this going to hurt the Mar-a-Lago investigation? Yes, it will become like Hillary's emails. It will become a false equivalency thing, just like we were part of the problem, frankly, in the false equivalency during the 2016 election.
Well, I don't
think
we gave false equivalency. We mentioned it. And let me read you what Kathy from Westboro says about those classified documents. One box with 15 documents turned over immediately and voluntarily, not even requested by the government, she means, versus 15 boxes and some 325 documents that Trump refused to give up for over 2 years, and only after the FBI raided the place, no equivalence in capital letters. I agree with every word she said, but I say to you, Kathy, and for people who feel that way, if you're a family with 3 kids in Ohio, and you're working a couple of jobs, and you got a lot of things to deal with, do you think you're going home to the dinner table and saying, well, let's discuss what the facts were of the situation with President Biden as opposed to Donald Trump? I'll quote Dana Bash again. If you're explaining, you are losing. It is totally unfair. It is probably inappropriate. And by the way, we have to be clear here. Based on the facts we know, you stated as a fact a minute ago, Biden's lawyers discovered these on November 2nd. We don't know if that's true. I don't know. Maybe it was October 2nd. Maybe it was a year ago, and they decided not to do anything.
Well, then all the people from the National Archives, I assume, would be lying to cover it up then.
No. The National Archives were notified on November 2nd.
Yeah, and they went and got them.
No, but my question is, did the lawyers only know about them on November 2nd? We're accepting as fact what they're saying.
Okay.
The thing that is indisputable, and for all the Kathys out there, and I think you to a degree, is this muddies the waters for the average fair-minded American. I'm not talking about the nuts.
It muddies the waters, but I would argue there's so much mud on one side that this is kind of a story that'll be a few days old. You have partisans of Trump talking about this all the time, and it'll be the same group arguing that this is ridiculous as argued that the election was stolen.
Well, you're not a Trump partisan. Would you feel an obligation? Let's assume Trump's indicted for Mar-a-Lago.
Uh-huh.
Next Thursday for the documents. If you were commenting on a cable show or here, would you not feel an obligation to bring up the Biden thing, even if you would argue that it was a false equivalency? Don't you think you have to?
Well,
I do.
I guess you have to, but the thing with Trump is obstructing the return of these things. I mean, they had to subpoena him. They notify them over and over and over again. You got to give these documents back. And that there's allegations of the documents being hidden and moved from one place to another.
And that they lied and that he wanted his lawyers to sign a document saying that we turned over everything when they hadn't.
It's sort of a sad state of affairs that we have such difficulty
distinguishing? No, it's not that sad because we have busy lives. And the vast majority of people are not watching CNN for 3 hours at night like you and me.
Here's the question which I was arguing with you about. So whose votes are changed about this? I mean, if we're worried about the votes,
I think independents in the middle who are fair-minded people who hopefully were disgusted by Trump's behavior are at least going to say, this concerns me.
Yeah.
This concerns me.
I don't think it rises to that.
Okay,
to that
maybe you're right. Rachel on the road, you're first on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about the disclosure that Joe Biden in his private office post-vice presidency had some classified documents there as well. Hey.
Hi, I'm just wondering why the National Archives isn't more like isn't more like a library, so that you...
What's going on, Rachel?
So that you, I'm trying to turn my radio off.
Oh, okay. But we can't hear it, so it's okay. So,
no, but she can't talk while we're on a delay. But go ahead, Rachel, okay, we're going to put you on hold. We'll come right back to you in a second. Don't go away. We'll take Derek in New Hampshire, and then we'll come right back to Rachel when she figures out the radio deal. Derek in New Hampshire, you're next on Boston Public Radio. What's up with you?
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I'd just like to echo most of what you've said. I just don't think that there's any equivalency here, and just because they're classified documents, I don't think that it has to be brought up in the same conversation with Trump. Like, I think that's the whole point of all of this, is that it's always this false equivalency or rationalizing current bad behavior by somebody else's past bad behavior. It's never, let's just address this specific issue for anyone's behavior ever.
Yeah, I guess I'm discussing political reality. What I think is political reality. Derek, I agree with every word you said. That's how it should be. And I hope it's the way it is, assuming the facts are as Biden's lawyers tell. But
I guess political reality. You look at, like, you know, a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters flip to Trump, and they're both sort of singing the same populist message here, right? And I think, you know, like where you say, oh, people aren't going home to have this conversation, but at the same token, we say the general populace is smart enough to be able to differentiate between right and wrong, et cetera. So, like, you know, what is it? Are they completely ignorant and oblivious,
I don't think they're ignorant and oblivious. I think they're busy is what I think they are. But, Derek, that was a great call, and you make wonderful points, and thanks for making it. Let me tell you what also complicates things a little bit. Okay. Here's a little sound of Joe Biden when president. This is September of last year on 60 Minutes. He gives his reaction to how Trump stored classified documents at Mar-a-Lago. Again, here's President Biden.
How that could possibly happen, how anyone could be that irresponsible. And I thought, what data was in there that may compromise sources and methods? By that, I mean names of people who helped, or et cetera. And it's just totally irresponsible.
Okay. I mean, there he is. And by the way, we have no idea yet, unless I've missed something. Correct me if I'm wrong, Marjorie. We don't know how serious and how deeply classified the documents are, if they did compromise, in Biden's office, if they did compromise sources and methods. But I think the prior caller is absolutely right, factually, and you're right. There is a clear distinction to be made based on what we know so far. I'm just not convinced that distinction will be made. What are you laughing about?
We have some good text messages. John from New Hampshire says, finally, some honesty from you and me, Jim. That's exactly why they covered it up till now, another Dem scam to influence an election. That's John from New Hampshire. Here's another one. It's a hoax. Fake news. It's a Republican witch hunt. That's from someone unsigned. And Beth from Newport says, one of the bigger issues, Trump did not comply and return the classified documents. Who's been impeached twice? Whose cabinet turned over more often than a room at Motel 6?
That's a good one. Our number is 877-301-8970. By the way, Marjorie said at the top of the show that we are streaming, as we do every day. We're in the library on youtube.com/GBH News. It appears that mountains of people are already on the YouTube. I would like watching us. I would like to think it's because they want to see how we're reacting to this important discussion. They're apparently there because they know that Jordan Knight from New Kids on the Block is on the show.
Yes.
And so in the spirit of fairness, which I shouldn't do because you're all going to turn us off, he will be with us at about 12:50.
He will.
He's not here to perform. He's here as the owner of a fabulous restaurant that just reopened after a fire in East Milton.
That's right. But we will have a shot or two of him performing.
Yes, we will.
And I think people can stay tuned for that. So here's Paul in Worcester. Another great excuse for Garland not doing his job. Trump will unfortunately be president in 2024. Paul does think people are stupid. So there you go, Jim.
Well, I, in response to that caller, who I think to a degree was politely baiting me, it's not stupidity. It's being busy with life. And I don't think most people have the ability to delve into the facts. Again, Dana Bash is as fair-minded as you can get on CNN. If you're explaining, you're losing. I think it's a cardinal rule of politics with which I sadly agree. Rachel on the road will try you again. Welcome to the show. Hi.
Hi, I'm wondering why the National Archives isn't more like your local public library. So if you check something out, they have a record of who took it, when they took it, and they would have said to Vice President Biden leaving office, hey, by the way, you know, I know you're a busy man, but you haven't returned these documents, at which point he probably would have done that, right?
Well, you know, I have to say,
I don't think it works like that.
I don't think so either. I think they get, I could be dead wrong. And Rachel, you sound like you know more than I do. I'm assuming it went from Vice President's office to his private office and bypassed the National Archives. I don't think the National Archives gets involved until after the fact.
No, I don't think so either.
But if I'm wrong, Rachel or somebody else should feel free to correct me.
Whatever. So how do classified documents get tracked? I would imagine they're in some kind of a library, and security is kept, and records are kept of who has them. I imagine it like a library. No, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either. Our staff will check it out. My assumption is when the elected individuals are in office, it's done at the White House in terms of what's in their possession. And, you know, by the way, I'm assuming you know this. I learned this, obviously, in last year, too. In terms of congressional access, they only have access to highly classified things. What are they called? These skiff rooms?
Skiff rooms.
Where they can't take the documents out.
Julia Kyle was always in a skiff room.
Didn't Sandy Berger stick them in his underpants
or
something like
that?
Socks, whatever.
Yeah.
In any case, Rachel, thank you for the call.
He got in big trouble, remember?
Yeah, was he prosecuted? I can't remember.
He was definitely prosecuted. I don't know what happened. But he did put classified documents in his socks, which you're not supposed to do.
It's a better story if he puts them in his underwear. I would say it's a much more appealing, but I guess it was his socks.
Yeah, you know, you think about how much room do most of us have in our socks? You know, not that much room. I have some new Bombas sockets I got for Christmas.
I know. Let's not go through Bombas.
There's
again,
no room for any classified documents in these socks. Okay, we're talking about this discovery of these classified documents in the locked office of President Joe Biden when he was not President Joe Biden, when he was out of office after he'd been Vice President for Barack Obama, asking whether this ruins the investigation into Trump's purloining of the documents and leaving them at Mar-a-Lago for many, many months. Our number is 877-301-8970. You're listening to Boston Public Radio live at the Boston Public Library. We are also streaming for you Jordan Knight fans live on youtube.com/GBHnews.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH. I'm just laughing because we have record numbers of people watching on YouTube. It's rather sad, by the way. We do not have record numbers because of the intelligence of our conversation about public policy.
Yeah.
It's all because they're waiting for Jordan Knight. By the way, if you're obsessed with Jordan Knight, which is perfectly fine, a local kid, as were his friends who made better than good, come down and see him here. He's going to be
right.
Here about 12:50.
He's going to be here.
Join
that
us at the Boston Public Library.
And as Ben from Peabody points out, clearly Jordan Knight is salivating over investigating what the Biden documents reveal. I think all America is.
We're going to press him on that. We're going to press him on the his position on the documents.
I think so. And Ted from Marshfield says, who's a big who's not a fan of Donald Trump, says if Biden were trafficking babies out of Pizza Hut, he'd still be preferable to the traitor Trump. The real problem is why are classified documents so easy to take out of the building? Checking my closet right now.
Okay, so here's a question for you before we get back to calls and texts at 877-301-8970. Donald Trump, this is a hypothetical, a made-up hypothetical. 6 days before the election, Donald Trump is president, by the way, running for re-election. 6 days before the election, his lawyers find that he has classified documents in his office, private office. They have 6 days to disclose before people vote. Well, obviously, a lot of people voted because there are new voting rules. But before voting ends, and he chooses not to disclose it for a couple of months. What would you say about Donald Trump?
I would say that it is a problem, but it's nowhere near as much of a problem as inciting a riot and violence.
I agree.
Why don't we dead people? It's not
more.
As much of a riot as calling up the Secretary of State in Georgia and saying, find me 11,000 votes. It's not as much of a problem as 24 women saying that you sexually assaulted them. So I think, you know, with Trump, it's just one other thing in a long line. I mean, where do we begin and end? You know, 25 million for faking, for screwing people out of money at a fake
But you do agree it makes Garland's, I mean, Garland allegedly, when you're the attorney general, you say all the time, and I believe it in his case, politics is irrelevant. I would argue politics are not irrelevant in this case. Would you not agree?
I think this is going to turn into be a big nothing, is what I think.
You mean the Biden thing?
Yeah.
I agree with that, but that's not my question. Do you not think it makes Merrick Garland's job a lot more difficult?
I think
when he announces an indictment of Donald Trump for the Mar-a-Lago documents, he is going to be asked the questions that you say are a false equivalent. By the way, based on what I know, I agree with you. But he is going to be asked those questions, and he's going to have to answer.
I think he is going to be asked those questions. But, you know, I guess my feeling is that I don't think in general, unless you're a real partisan, you think Joe Biden, who was the poorest member of Congress for like 50 years, is a crook.
73 million people voted for a guy who I think most of them objectively knew was a crook and a sexual harasser and a sexual assaulter. And 73 million voted for him. You think they didn't think in his reelection bid?
No, I think people thought these women were all making it up to get rich, which is a big joke, because which of them has gotten rich off these?
So can't people who think the women are making it up be the same people who think Joe Biden's a crook?
I think that I don't know why people voted for Donald Trump. I think it had to do with I don't know why people voted for Donald
Trump. Let's go. Where do you want to go?
Let's go to George in Eastham. Hi, George.
Hey, George. Welcome.
Hello. I just have a comment about the classified information.
Please.
I'm a retired federal employee.
Oh, great.
Every time I had to deal with classified information, we had to keep it in a safe, logged separately by job issue, check it back in. If we took it to our desk for a couple hours, worked on it, when we were finished and went to lunch, we had to put it back into the safe. Everything is logged and categorized. Top secret and above stuff has to go into a skiff, but secret, confidential, and other information you can work on at your desk. At least that's where I was.
So there
is a track record for everything.
Based on your level of knowledge, which far exceeds ours, what are your preliminary conclusions based on what we know, admittedly, very early on about the situation with Joe Biden?
Well, at my level, when I was working on it day to day, I had to deal with it this way. As vice president, he may have had underlings that were in charge of handling this, and he may have had no knowledge. Or, you know, to suspect the worst, he may have taken the documents. I kind of doubt it, but anything's possible.
Thank you. That was helpful. We really appreciate your expertise. George, thanks for calling. What are you laughing about?
Could Jim find any documents in his socks with that Morton's toe? Benjamin and Brett wants to know about that. Morton's toe is when your second toe is bigger than your big toe.
Yeah. By the way, it's great you brought that up because that's really relevant to this discussion. That's one. And number two, I feel obligated because you do this all the time. Marjorie, it's sort of, what's the word? Is exuberant about saying that my father did jail time, which he did not, but you've only said it about 400 times, that I was arrested because of stealing from the Wawa supermarket where I was the assistant manager when I was in college. Yeah. I was not arrested. I did refuse to take a lie detector test. And by the way, the Morton's toe situation you described, if you've ever looked at my feet when I'm wearing sandals, not that there's anything wrong with Morton's toe. I don't have Morton's toe, Marjorie.
Yeah, my point is that just like Donald Trump has a shaky past, some other people have a shaky past around here as well. Paul from Bourne, thank you for calling.
Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, how are you guys?
Good.
Jim, I completely buy your point that people are busy. And I think, though, you and Marjorie have been avoiding the media's culpability in all of this. It seems to me that the Trump offenses are always characterized as FBI raids Trump, government picking on Trump, DOJ picking on Trump, and the Biden coverage is, look what Biden might have done wrong. Look what Biden might have done wrong. And the busy American who's constantly bombarded with, why is always everyone picking on Trump? And then this repeated, Biden might have done something wrong, Biden might have done something wrong. Is the media just unconsciously responding to These are the emotions that people want to have stirred up.
Well, Paul, let me say two things. Can I be defensive? Can I be defensive for a minute? We have never once said that, not once. That's not been our angle on Trump and Mar-a-Lago or anything else. I do agree.
You didn't lead with FBI raids Mar-a-Lago?
No. No.
What did you lead with?
We led with the fact that, in fact, this was the exact opposite, is there was voluntary turnover by Biden's people.
No. Back when Mar-a-Lago was the thing.
No, I'm sure we talked about. Well, I think respectfully, I think you are wrong. I think we talked about a former president.
Was not.
What's that?
The pervasive lead was not Trump has been lying to the government for 3 months.
Well, yeah, you were listening to a different show.
Paul, hold on for a second. I'm trying to figure out what you're saying. Are you saying that the media, what are you saying the media does? They treat Trump differently than Biden or Democrats different from Republicans?
Yes, yeah.
The media reinforces a lower standard of expected behavior for Trump than for Biden.
Well, let me say, while I don't think I agree with that, what I do think I agreed with, which Marjorie pled guilty to about 10 minutes ago, Paul, is the false equivalency thing during the Clinton Trump race for president. I don't think we were as bad as some of our colleagues, but some days we were.
Well,
I think your point is well taken, but I think we learned our lesson.
I think what is happening today is that reporters that are so conscious of going after Trump constantly for his many, many sins and probably criminal sins are worried about being even-handed. And so when Biden comes out and he's found in this mess with these documents, they have to rush to cover the Biden story so that people can't say, oh, well, you ignore it when
President
Biden does it.
Well, by
the way,
let me just say, that's exactly what I said to you this morning. Yeah. However, I want to be clear to you.
So I think we're doing that, too.
No, we are not.
Okay,
because the difference is, I said to you and our colleagues this morning, I think we have an obligation to talk about this.
Right.
However, I don't know what even-handed means. I think we did exactly what Paul wants us to do, is to say that based upon what we know, these are apples and oranges. My contention, though, is politically that's a hard case to make. Factually, it's not. But I think we did have an obligation to talk about it. Paul, it was a great call, and we're glad you made it. And I hope we're not as guilty as charged, but thank you for listening and calling.
Well, here's Art from West Bridgewater, who is one of our conservative listeners. He says the only clear distinction is one is Trump and one is Biden.
If you're
a Trump fan, you see it one way. If you're a Trump hater, you see it the other way.
You know,
I think there's truth in that.
No, there's no truth in that, because the facts are based upon what we know now are totally different.
Right.
Voluntary disclosure with no subpoenas, no obstruction, and no lying. That's a pretty significant difference.
But I think that the way this will be played by Trump supporters is that this is
maybe that's the same thing
that Trump did, when it isn't the same thing that Trump did.
Let's take one more call.
Tom and Dedham, thank you for calling.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I want to make a distinction between different classification documents. As a previous caller had indicated, you know, there's confidential, there's secret, there's top secret, then there's SCI level documents. The confidential documents do not need to be under lock and key in a safe. They can be lock and key in your desk. So if Trump has TSSCI, those must be locked in a safe. But if Biden has just confidential, then that can be locked in a
Tom, that may be all factually true. It's not that relevant to these facts. His own lawyers admit, Biden's, that the documents shouldn't have been in his private office. So regardless of what level of classification, he himself, through his lawyers, acknowledged they shouldn't be there. By the way, and thank you for the call. The thing we should add to the distinction, beyond the obstruction and the subpoenas and the lying through the lawyers, Trump also lied about orally declassifying all the documents on his way out of the White House. Absolutely no evidence of any of that.
One of our texters did point that out, though, that his understanding is that Biden declassified them with his mind from afar.
This is really...
So, yeah.
Okay.
Okay. We're
going to talk to John King about this, too, a little bit later in the show. So stick around for that.
Yeah, coming up, we're going to talk to NBC Sports Boston's Trenti Casey. She's next to give us the latest on DeMar Hamlin, the Buffalo Bills player, who was had to be resuscitated twice after a game last week, and she'll try to explain the phenomenon of the Texas Christian Horned Frogs, Hypnotoad. If you hadn't heard about Hypnotoad, you're going to hear about them next, listening to Boston Public Radio 89.7, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Libraries. We do every Tuesday and every Friday, and we are streaming on youtube.com/GBHnews.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews. We're joined by another person who's only here because she thought Jordan Knight was going to be here now. It's Trenny Casey. Trenny is an anchor and reporter with NBC Sports Boston and a BPR contributor. I really am sorry that he won't be here for 2 hours, Trenny.
I am so bummed. I mean, so I'm 45.
Yes, you are.
So when I was like in the 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, like new kids were everything. I had posters. The first concert I ever went to, like with just my friends, Julie White and this other girl, Heather, whose last name I can't remember. We had like, we were center stage, probably only 7 or 10 rows back. And I remember I loved Jordan Knight's shoes that he was wearing. And I begged my mom to like get me shoes like Jordan, like a boy was wearing. I was a girl and I wanted like shoes like Jordan Knight's. I was like, they're so dreamy. But my real crush, no offense, Jordan, my real crush was Joey McIntyre.
Oh, wow.
Because he was, like, closer in age. Like, he was the younger one of the group. And so when I was a kid, I went to the local public library and took out – this is how old I am – and took out a Boston yellow white pages that had phone numbers in it. And, like, I after reading, like, Tiger
really
Beat
sad.
And Teen Bop, I think I knew what his parents' names were. So I found their name in the thing. And my mom was like, why are these long-distance phone calls to Boston? And I was like, because I was calling Joey McIntyre's house and hanging up. I don't know if it was his house.
I love it.
Now that I lived here, I'm like, there's probably 10,000 McIntyres in the greater Boston area. And I probably called, like, 10 of them. And we're like, is this Joey's house?
This is rather sad. In
any
case,
I met him.
Which one?
Joey.
Yeah.
At the Super Bowl in Houston in whenever the Patriots played Atlanta, the 28-3 game and won in Houston.
Yeah.
And I was like, I'm never tongue-tied. Like, I'll talk to anyone. My face was as red as a stop sign. And I have this picture with him, and I am just, like, beaming and shaking. I'm like, Joey McIntyre. But apparently he has a really lovely wife and is this great husband and wife. And now I have a lovely husband. So, but hey, you know, you're on my list.
Those teen crushes.
You're on my list, Joey.
Do you remember
just know
them?
It. My husband knows.
Forever.
We're talking to Trenny Casey, theoretically, about the sports scene.
Well, we are going to talk about the sports scene. And we're going to start with the a little sound from the game last week between the Buffalo Bills and New England Patriots. The opening sound, really. What we're going to play is the first time that the Buffalo Bills took the field since DeMar Hamlin nearly died on the field 2 weeks ago. The Bills opened rather strong, returning the opening kickoff for a touchdown. Yeah. Here's announcer Jim Nance.
And here's Hines on the run back, breaking a tackle and taking it past midfield. And down the sideline he goes. This is storybook. An opening kickoff return for DeMar Hamlin. And this place is absolutely going wild.
Gave me chills. You know, it really did.
It still does when I
me
listen
too.
To it. The best part of it, though, is so they pan to a shot of Sean McDermott. Sean McDermott on the sidelines, the head coach of the Buffalo Bills. And he was crying. You could see it was just like,
this
I think like a release of emotions and some relief. And DeMar Hamlin at that point was watching from his hospital bed in Cincinnati. An update on him, he is doing well enough that he was able to return to Buffalo yesterday. He is still being treated in a Buffalo hospital. So he's still in the hospital. But the doctors did say that he is making expected, even accelerated progress on his trajectory.
It's not even and 8 days, by the way. It
I know.
Is truly
you know, it was
incredible.
Great, too. When
Eight days.
When they had their touchdowns, they're making the heart.
The tight end.
Yes,
because
he does
that. So that DeMar Hamlin could see them.
Everybody had threes on.
But you kind of knew. The Patriots, needless to say, have not had a great season. They're not going to be in the playoffs.
No.
You knew that they were going down last
I actually,
Sunday.
I have to say this about the Patriots. I was impressed with how they played. Because if you watched, and I actually DVR'd the game and went back and watched the first couple sequences, And the way Buffalo came out, even not just on that opening kickoff, but if you watch the Patriots' first offensive possession, the Buffalo defense is all over Mac Jones, and the Patriots looked shell-shocked, like they were just going to be running for their lives all day. But they settled in. They tied the game. They actually, the Patriots' offense actually scored more points than Buffalo's offense, 23 points to 21. Mac Jones, at least through three quarters, had a pretty good game, and they looked better. But it's like, well, special teams was terrible. They gave up two kickoff returns, one for 96 yards, one for 101. And Josh Allen is so, it was going to be hard to beat them on that day. Even if he made some mistakes. He had a pick right before halftime. He wasn't as sharp as he can, but he's just, listen, I love Mac Jones. I think he seems like a great kid, but he is nowhere near the talent Josh Allen is. I mean, you see that guy throw a pass, and it is just perfectly thrown. He has such a big arm. It's just they're
yeah.
Worlds
I
apart.
Mean, Josh Allen is good. He's no Jordan Knight or Joey McIntyre, though. I mean, that's ridiculous. You know, you and I had a little debate last week, which I don't want to get into it again. You know, was this a football injury? Was it not? Obviously, it was an injury that happened on the football field.
Yes.
And it has caused people for a week, 7.5 days so far, to talk about violence in football, even if this is not like a concussion kind of
right.
thing, which is obviously a function of football. Is this one of these one and done kind of things and everybody returns to normal, whether it's the NFL, health advocates, other than the Great Concussion Legacy Foundation, or are people going to get serious about making this a safer game? By the way, one way to make it safer is not on the field, but to ensure that layers down, I guess it's not an NFL issue, have the kind of staffing and equipment
yes.
that allows, if it was a college player or a high school player who had the exact same experience as Hamlin, that he had a chance to survive.
That is where I'm hopeful the change happens. Like, listen, again, this happened on a football field, but, we still don't know. That is
That's
the interesting
true.
Thing. We don't know if he had a pre-existing condition that led him to have cardiac arrest or if it was commotio cordis.
Who?
Commotio cordis is what it's called when you are struck in the chest at the exact, like, wrong time, basically.
Right. Oh, that it's second like, in the rhythm of your heart.
It's that second in the rhythm of your heart when it's on, like, the downbeat. I'm not a doctor, so I won't even try to explain it.
Marjorie
but basically
is.
What it does is it causes cardiac arrest.
Like, yes.
And it's not very common, but it's much more common in sports with projectiles. So baseball, hockey, and lacrosse. And the New Orleans Saints, and I believe the New Orleans Pelicans, if I'm remembering this correctly, they actually donated a substantial amount of money to local rec programs in the wake of this happening. And I haven't seen if any
other... You mean in their community?
In their community,
yeah.
If other teams have done
this.
That's
great, actually.
Because what saved DeMar Hamlin's life, it was partially CPR. I've read numerous articles about CPR classes around the country mm-hmm. filling up in the wake of this.
Oh, really?
Because CPR is what initially saved his life, but what really saved his life was the AED, the defibrillators. But I looked today on my way here, defibrillators cost $1,500 to over $2,000
yeah.
each. So like at NBC, I didn't know this. We have like, I think, six of them strategically located based on our emergency management team's suggestions around the newsroom in case we have a medical emergency. But, you know, Comcast NBC Universal is a multi-billion dollar corporation. If you're playing in youth soccer or youth football or youth baseball, you know, if you're in a school, you don't necessarily have an extra $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 to have these readily available where they need to be for kids. So I hope what ends up happening is that the NFL and other sports teams come together, NHL teams, baseball teams, and then take money charitably and donate it to youth problems. Because it's also, we had a doctor on my show last week, what commotio cordis is actually quite uncommon in grown adults, because we have our chests are full grown and our lungs and the chest plate is
yeah.
full grown to sustain the blow. But it's not very common. It is more common, only happens about 30 times a year, but it is more common in children ages 5 to 18 when your body isn't, and really 5 to 15 when your body isn't full grown yet. So to have these, I think just to have the knowledge of it. And also, if you're a parent and your child plays baseball, have them wear a chest pad.
Yeah.
Have them wear protective covering so that if they are hit by a baseball and something happened, like that, you know, that there's protection there so that it doesn't happen. You know,
wait a second. Hey, Jordan. Jim Browder, can you come here a second, please? This woman is Trenny Casey.
Oh, my God. I'm such a huge Newcastle fan.
This woman cannot even talk because she knew you were coming on the show. Can you help her out in any kind of – you don't have a microphone, but if you want me to communicate anything, can you shake her hand? Can you walk over
there? It's okay. We can wait until it's done.
No,
I got to leave when you're done.
Don't go away. I want to say something else to Jordan.
I have to take my dog's poop to the vet.
Oh my God.
Here we go.
Look at her face. Look at her face. This is pathetic. The guy owns a restaurant. Who gives a damn what he does?
I'll put this back on. I told this story when I was in seventh grade.
Jordan, put
I
on
saw
the head. Do you mind putting on the headphone over there?
I saw New
Jordan
Kids.
Knight has just shown up early
first...
for a segment here.
It was my first ever concert as a grown-up. Well, not a grown-up. I saw us at Alpine Valley. It's like in Alpine Valley,
we lost
in East Troy,
show.
Wisconsin.
Go ahead.
I'm from Wisconsin.
Yep.
And we sat center, and I loved your shoes, so I made my mom.
My shoes?
Yes, I made my mom buy me shoes that like you wore.
But what year was this?
I was in seventh grade, so probably 1988, 89, 90, somewhere in there. I graduated
it's
from high school in 95.
We were both very young at that time.
Very young.
But somehow I would suspect that Jordan Knight has had these kind of conversations probably
maybe more than
hundreds
once.
Of
yeah,
times.
Like how many women my age are like, oh, my God, Jordan
once,
Knight.
Once or twice.
Once or twice, a likely story.
It's a good thing my husband doesn't listen to
now,
this
Jordan,
show.
Before you, I don't even know why you're here this early, but in any case, before you go.
You want to have some bite to eat.
This show, when
cafe.
We're at the library, our show streams on YouTube. We apparently have a record number of YouTube viewers today.
Not for not talking about the Patriots.
I think it's probably because of the discussion about Biden's classified documents. Would you not agree?
Oh, everyone's tuning in for that.
Exactly. Absolutely. So I just wanted to run that by you. Okay, you're excused. You're going to be back at about 12:50.
Glad I wore my best
Can we hear it for Jordan
today.
Knight? Woo! He's here to talk about a restaurant, not the Trenny Casey problem here.
Okay.
By the way, I've never seen you red or...
Redder, like
I know,
a lobster.
I don't ever, like, no offense, but most celebrities don't really... I don't know, I'm around, you know, I cover athletes, so I don't care about athletes. But for me, like, this is something like this is like, you know, I guess, Marjorie, you probably like, would you like Elvis? I don't know.
Excuse me?
I'm not that
Elvis?
Old.
The Beatles? I don't know.
No, Charlie Chaplin and she were like so tight. It was incredible.
Bob Dylan?
Okay.
I like Bob Dylan. That's for
I don't
sure.
know. I'm just trying to think of somebody like in the 70s. Oh, who are the Stayin' Alive guys?
Oh, the Bee Gees.
The Bee Gees. Like,
by the way,
know.
For those, we're going to leave this out. Jordan's going to be back with his colleague. They both own Navarro, which just reopened in Milton after a fire. We're going to talk restaurants as we do quite regularly. Back to sports, though.
Well, but I just one thing I want to mention on a kind of an upsetting note that this one of these stories that this is in the New York Times talked about this high school basketball star, this Danny Rumpf, you know, who died from cardiac arrest in a pickup basketball game. His mother started this foundation, and one of the things that they did was to provide these free electrocardiogram screenings. For athletes between the ages of 5 and 19, they screened 61 of them and found 11 of them with
incredible.
Heart abnormalities. Yeah. So it raises the question, and I remember at my own kid's school, a kid died in running a mile. They absolutely had no idea that there was anything wrong. They just go out in gym class, ran a mile, the kid collapsed, died.
I would wonder why, you know, if this is something that especially can be exacerbated by sports, and in particular high-intensity activities, why not make it part of your child's yearly examination?
Exactly. This is what drives me crazy. There are preventative tests in medicine. Obviously, everybody gets breast exams now, right? That's a big thing.
Well, after
or prostate
40.
Exams, you get the.
You know why it costs money?
Yeah, that's why.
And that this is something. You're the math genius there. 11 people out of 61. That's a huge.
That's like 20%.
Yeah,
it's huge.
So if these heart abnormalities are so common in young people, why don't we check them?
I think that was the point that Trenny was making. There's a lot more sensitivity to that now, whether it's the New Orleans professional teams or I'm assuming a lot of high schools and leagues are going to be under a lot of pressure to spend a little bit of dough to be prepared for this kind. By the way, I just want to do a shout out. When you mentioned the defibrillator, Dr. Bernard Lown, who won the Nobel Peace Prize and died at 100 last year, I had the privilege of working with on a ballot question a couple of decades ago with the late John O'Connor. He invented this defibrillator right down the street here in Brookline and has saved thousands and thousands and thousands of lives because of his important work. So shout out to the late Dr. Lown.
Okay.
I will say this, just one to put a bow on this. You know, lacrosse is now different than other sports where they require all players, because they did have a player at Cornell die on the field in 2000, I believe, three or four. And then in 2020 or 2021, a lacrosse player was hit with a ball in the chest, collapsed, had to be revived. And from that point forward, lacrosse has required not just goalies to wear chest protectors. Every player on the field playing men's lacrosse has to wear a chest protector.
You know,
so these things do scare teams and leagues and rec leagues and, you know, athletic associations around the country, hopefully into doing things that will prevent something like happening that happened to DeMar Hamlin.
Can we talk about the Patriots for a minute?
Or at least save their lives.
A quick minute, because I want to talk about the hypnotherapy.
I know you do. Just one second here. You know that I fall
didn't work last night
on the Brady versus Belichick thing. I'm not saying Belichick's not a fine coach. But
oh, I'm now on Team Jim on this.
Brady is the reason they were the team they were for 20 years. And here's a question for you. And this is not my usual anti-Belichick diatribe, because he treats the media like absolute garbage, which drives me nuts. It is a fact-based thing. If you're the coach of a team, no matter what your history is, 2 out of 3 years in a row you've had a losing record,
yeah,
with an owner who demands excellence, namely Robert Kraft. When he announced yesterday, Belichick, I'm back for my 24th season tomorrow, is that just a given? Or does an owner say,
sure,
you're not producing the way we need you to produce, and as a result, we got to look elsewhere?
I mean, I don't think Belichick is going to be the first to go. I do think Robert Kraft, because of his track record, which it does mean something, will give him the opportunity to bring in coaches who, oh, I don't know, can actually coach offense. You know, aren't defensive coordinators and a failed head coach who almost ruined a quarterback.
But they were all Belichick's decisions.
They were all Belichick's decisions. And Robert Kraft, in March, while at the owners' meetings, did make a comment when asked about his decision to promote Matt Patricia and Joe Judge. And for those of you who don't know, by the way, the reason Bill Belichick does these things is because it's cheap. Both Joe Judge and Matt Patricia were both fired by their teams as head coaches.
Because they were unsuccessful.
So they're being paid, Matt Patricia by the Lions, Joe Judge by the Giants. So he doesn't have to, if he doesn't give them a title, he doesn't have to pay them. And the other teams are paying for those two guys to be coaches on his team. So it's inexpensive for him.
But, you know, the other thing, can I just say one more point about this?
Not only
I know this is the last question about the Patriots. Not only is Kraft an impatient person, he's an 80-something.
Yeah. And Bill Belichick is in his 70s. I know he really wants to. I mean, from what I understand, I shouldn't say I know. It's like Bill calls me up and is like, hey, I really want to catch Don Shula. But he has an opportunity to catch Don Shula to be winning as head coach.
I wouldn't care if he was 80 if he was winning.
Which is why I don't understand why he makes these decisions that he always says, I do what's in the best interest of the team, right? I don't think hiring a defensive coordinator to be your offensive coordinator is the best interest of the team.
I think he'll
be back, Jim, but Greg Bedard of Boston Sports Journal said on Boston Sports Tonight on our air last night, he's not 100% certain that Bill will be back.
Okay, take it away, Marjorie.
Okay, a texter just informed us that they grew up in Boston and was on the receiving end of all those phone calls Trenny made to find Joey McIntyre, because his parents' phone number was just
really
a digit
sad.
Off than the texter. So how about that? You tormented this person that is now listening to our show.
I mean, I don't think it was only me. I'm sure I was not the only crazy teenage girl who made prank calls.
Okay, red
but
again,
we want to get to the most important story of the day, the tale of the hypnotoad.
Yes.
Okay, so here's the deal. Last night, University of Georgia Bulldogs crushed the TCU Horned Frogs.
Was it 65-7?
65-7
in the college football championship. But for the underdog TCU, this was an achievement just to reach the stage. And a lot of the hype around the season could be attributed to their adopted mascot, the Hypnotoad, from the animated sitcom Futurama. Here's a clip for the show where the Hypnotoad puts a group of judges under a trance.
And here's second place? That's a fancy word for losing. You didn't stick your landing.
Forgive me, my friend.
Never!
And the grand prize winner,
the Hypnotoad.
Okay.
All glory to the Hypnotoad.
Okay.
Do you know how much a bunch of Gen Zers are like, I don't know why this 45-year-old lady's freaking out over some guy who owns a restaurant in Milton. I have no idea what Futurama is or why it's a big thing. But apparently
the TCU team
attributed part of their success to the fact that their fan base adopted this they're the Horned Frogs, TCU Horned Frogs. That's their mascot. And they adopted this. And once they adopted it, they just started winning and winning and winning all these games that they weren't expected to. And they ended up in the national title game. game. So
yeah, or they putting up some
Hypnotoad did not matter last night because Georgia absolutely. It wasn't even a game. Georgia.
How humiliating! I feel horrible. For
I actually
these kids.
Do feel bad for.
Didn't
them.
They put the Hypnotoad behind the goalposts and so they're supposed yes. to distract the, yes. The kicker?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think it does. I don't think David Copperfield could have distracted Georgia last night.
What is with you and the Hypnotoad? You come in this morning. All you wanted to talk about yesterday was Prince Will or whatever his name is.
Oh, Prince
or
Harry.
Harry. Sorry, Harry, not Will.
No, Prince
and today
Harry.
It's what's with you and the Hypnotoad?
I just thought it was kind of funny. That's all. I looked at the Hypnotoad. I thought the Hypnotoad was sort of a bizarre-looking little frog. And
can I ask you a question about last night? I didn't watch last night's game. We have only a minute left. I didn't watch last night's game. Did Georgia? Oh, you don't know either.
I mean, it seems to me
that when you're beating somebody like by 40 points,
just stop.
It's time to put in the fifth team or whatever it is. Put in the scrubs. And let him finish the game. I mean, no?
No. I mean, yes, I would. I don't know why. Like, it's not. Also, why not give all those kids who have given their time and their effort but don't get any of the glory some time to go on the field? I don't know if they did it or not.
I
honestly have no idea. Truth be told, I hate college football.
Why do you hate college football?
Because I just think, I mean, like, listen, basketball's not all that clean either, but it's not quite as dirty as college football.
Dirty hell.
Like, I just think there's a lot. There's always been a lot of dirty money, more so in football, like, across the board. I don't like that these kids, I don't like this idea that we...
Transferring?
It's that we sell them this bill of goods that they're going to be these student athletes and they're going to go to class. And the number of football players who skate by and don't actually go to class, and football is their number one priority because it is, forget basketball, it is the biggest moneymaker in college sports. They're not going there to get an education. They are going there to play football and bring glory to a bunch of athletic directors who get
and make a huge amount of money.
And make a huge amount of money.
On that note, unfortunately, Derrick Jackson.
College basketball is not that much better.
Well, I was just going to say, Derrick Jackson is no longer at the Boston Globe, unfortunately. He's doing wonderful work with the Union of Concerned Scientists. His annual bracket for March Madness, where he didn't rate the teams in the final 64 based upon their performance on the court,
but
graduation rates, yeah, was one of the most important acts of
when
exposure.
When Marquette calls me, and if I do donate, I designate it for something because the last thing I wanted to go to is the athletic department, at least not like basketball. I love Marquette basketball, and I want them to do well. But I know it's dirty. College sports are dirty.
Trina, your husband just texted. He has a little concern about what happened on our air. You should call him immediately after the segment.
Okay.
Nice to see you, Trina.
Trina Casey, newlywed Trina Casey, is also an anchor and reporter for NBC Sports and apparently a huge fan of New Kids on the Block. Joey McIntyre and Jordan Knight, who was nice enough to hug her. She could barely
hug her
herself.
Closely, I would
hug
say,
her closely.
Based upon
it was
my
very, it was very nice.
Yes.
Okay, up next, now that there's a new House Speaker, the C-SPAN cameras are out of the House chamber. We're stuck with the government-approved camera feeds, so we can't really see much of democracy in action after we did last week, whatever you thought of it. We'll speak with American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts Executive Director Carol Rose. She's up next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH, live from the Boston Public Library and streaming on youtube.com/GBH.
I'm Jim Browdy, ahead on Boston Public Radio, live from the Boston Public Library. It's a new year with new priorities for the Massachusetts Civil Liberties Union. We'll catch up with their executive director, Carol Rose, on those, and Governor Healey's decision to break with her predecessors on public records laws. Then, a story about corrupt governments, smartphones, and a little-known spyware program called Pegasus. It's all brought into focus in a new series from Frontline and Friends. We'll talk with producer Laurent Richard.
I'm Marjorie Egan. You may know him from his life as a member of New Kids on the Block, but Jordan Knight is making a name for himself in the restaurant world, too, with the recently reopened Novara in Milton. He'll join us alongside Novara's co-owner, Vance Welch. Then it's CNN's John King on what's shaping up to be a chaotic start for the House under Speaker Kevin McCarthy. All that and more ahead, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A U.S. official tells NPR up to 100 Ukrainians will be training on the Patriot missile system at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The official says these would likely be the first Ukrainians trained in the United States since the Russian invasion of the former Soviet Republic. Other Ukrainians are taking part in combat training at U.S. facilities in Germany. President Biden's meeting this hour with Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on the sidelines of the North American Summit in Mexico.
What we should be doing, and we are doing, is demonstrating the unlimited economic potential
that we have when we work together.
Economic ties, immigration, regional security, all dominating discussions. NPR's Ada Peralta reports the U.S., Canadian, and Mexican leaders also considering an international intervention in Haiti.
Haiti is a country in freefall. The country is besieged by gangs and has delayed elections for so long.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio live from the Boston Public Library, where we broadcast every Tuesday and every Friday. And we are streaming on YouTube.com/GBH News. And apparently we have a lot of streamers today. Jim, you know why?
Yeah.
Because Jordan Knight from the New Kids on the Block is going to be with us later. And everybody's lining up to get their good positions so they can be ready when he reappears.
Yeah. When Trini left, she needed an EMT to take her to her car. You know, Friday, we're broadcasting live from the Embrace unveiling on Boston Common. We're really thrilled and honored to be part of this. We'll have a show 11 to 1. We'll be interviewing a lot of the dignitaries and leaders who were there for the dedication. Then we'll carry the ceremony itself live starting at 1 till its conclusion. Here at the BPL, there'll be a listening and watch party for our show and the ceremony. No tickets or RSVP needed. First, though, we're joined by Carol Rose. She's the executive director of the Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts. Carol, good to see you.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Thanks for coming.
I have to say, I'm a little nervous. Like, I might have the right stuff, but let me just say that putting me between your Jordan Knight and your viewers, I'm
this
a little
is
nervous.
Unbelievable.
I know. It's so exciting. Really. Congratulations.
People
it's
are
great.
Very, people are very excited. It's but wonderful. You're dressed up today. You look very nice.
Thank you.
So there you go.
Look,
so,
she's talking to me.
We all watched.
No,
we got some complaints about you.
I don't care about this anymore.
Today,
I'm trying to be
actually.
Comfortable, which allows me to perform yep. my work a little
People
bit better than
if
I'd be
you
able
showered today, Jim.
I actually shower every day. Thank you, Marjorie, for bringing it up. Thank you again.
Texters are
it's
wondering.
A civil rights issue.
It is
the
a
ACLU.
Civil,
civil rights issue.
Yeah.
That's right. So you know, no matter what you thought about the politics of last week, it was kind of cool to be able to watch the House in session and people gossiping and the almost fisticuffs,
yeah.
you know, and the, with it, that represent congressman went after
it
Matt Gaetz, and Matt Gaetz is pointing his finger at Kevin McCarthy and all that excitement. And you saw
yeah.
Marjorie Taylor Greene whispering in people's ears.
Absolutely. Sunshine
all,
is the best
But it's all over.
Amen.
It's all over now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah. Well, that's the thing. C-SPAN doesn't have the right to just go in there all the time. That depends on what the majority party, in this case the Republicans, do. But until such time as they had a speaker, the C-SPAN was able to do that. And think how much we learned about what's going on
it was great.
In our Congress and in democracy. Yeah, I mean, this is why it's so important that to have cameras in courtrooms and cameras in legislatures and cameras in Congress and all these things, because it enables the people to really participate and see what's going on in our democracy.
And not be subject to lying. I'm assuming when mm-hmm. we all saw Mike Rogers from Alabama, I think he is,
yep.
the chair of, is it the Armed Services Committee?
I'm not sure.
Lunge at yeah. Matt Gaetz at about midnight. I'm assuming it wasn't a lunge. He wasn't angry. He wasn't whatever. But we saw he was angry, and we saw
right.
it was a lunch. You know, the thing that well, first of all, here's Chip Roy, who, by the way, was one of the 20 holdouts
yep.
until he wasn't. He was asked by Jake Tapper on CNN the night this is all happening about the C-SPAN cameras in the House chamber for that debate.
What the American people were able to see unfold on the floor was a good thing for our democracy and our republic, right? It was a good thing for people to be able to see the inner workings. And this isn't just a shirts and skins, red and blue, you know, two-team thing. This is history because this hasn't happened in the last 100 years. But understand why that's so.
So it's a good thing to be able to see the inner workings, but not good enough thing for him to vote against the rules package that guaranteed that we won't be able to see the
exactly.
inner workings. There's no basis for somebody like you, your organization. There's no legal cause of action here to argue that we, the American people, should have access to what our legislators are doing, right?
Right. No, there was actually, here in Massachusetts, there actually was a case back in 1997.
Was?
Right, yeah. And that had to do with whether or not all branches of government are subject to the public records
law. Oh, we're going to get to that in a minute,
right,
yeah.
Which is another form of transparency. And the court ruled that unless it's explicitly put in legislation, there isn't an inherent right. So I think that's important to say that we have to actually pass an affirmative statute to make it so.
You know what's really, I don't know if you know, but one of my many causes at which I have been wildly unsuccessful is cameras in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. Virtually every state court in the country has cameras in the courtroom.
Yes.
Two justices who we often praise, I believe I'm right, Kagan and Sotomayor in their confirmation hearing said they thought it was a good idea, and then as soon as they were on the court, they thought it was a bad idea. So not only, you know, the argument is it affects litigants, it affects witnesses. Hasn't affected anybody in state courts, yet federal courts keep them out. Right. I know there was an experiment in the federal court
people
here
couldn't
years
see
ago.
The Whitey Bulger trial.
Right, exactly.
Or they couldn't see the Tsarnaev trial.
Or the Tsarnaev trial.
Yeah, I mean,
but
what a disgrace.
What
yeah.
is the argument, speaking of cameras, what even if Supreme Court justice, by the way, Congress could change all this.
Correct.
In terms of the Supreme Court, what is the argument a member of the Supreme Court makes as to the undue influence of a camera on the performance of somebody, namely nine justices of the Supreme Court? It's ridiculous.
Right. Are they suggesting that perhaps they are subject to political influence?
Well, that is that's the implicit argument, isn't it?
Exactly. That's the implicit argument, which is why it should be there. Now, they started doing sound recordings a few years ago,
I know that.
Which are helpful.
Well, they're live. Are they live now? Yeah. Not at times?
Both and recorded. Yeah. But, you know, I just really think that it's important that in a democracy, nothing in our government should be secret. You know, this is the people's house. The legislature is the people's house. The courts belong to the people, to all of us. And I think that we should be able to see what's going on in our democracy, and there should be no secrets in that sense.
Well, you know, can I say, I'm sorry, go ahead, Marjorie.
I'm just embarrassed to say that I didn't realize in Massachusetts, and we're going to talk about Governor Healey, says she's not going to be. Actually, Jim Brown, you get some credit
here. We'll get
to
this, yeah.
Because you asked her about this. I was going to move on to this.
Oh, no. Fine. I don't know if we have the sound or we don't have the sound. We don't have the sound. It's okay.
Yeah. You asked her whether she was going to, you'll support legislation at least cuts back whatever exemptions the legislature and judiciary believe they have, and asked her if she was going to not be subject to this herself, that she would be open to the public records law. And she said yes. So that's great.
No. She said yes, she would not be exempt.
Right.
And yes, she would support legislation. Yes
that's right. Mm-hmm. So good for her. But I didn't realize that in 1997, the Supreme Judicial Court changed this to this.
That's the same case she was just talking
about.
Yeah,
I didn't know it was 1997, I'm embarrassed to say, to make this really secretive. So we have the most secretive government.
Yeah, we're only one of two states where the governor's office is not subject to the public records law inherently. So this is such good news. So first of all, thank you. And this is where the media, the fourth estate, is so important to keep our government, our officials, elected officials, accountable and open. So thank you, Jim.
Really. You're welcome.
But she did say
she was going to. I would thank the governor. She's the one who said yes.
And that is such good news. I mean, a really good news story coming out of Governor Healey's office saying that she will actually be subject to the public records law. Her office will be subject to it. And I think it's time to bring Massachusetts in line with all the other states but one.
You know, you mentioned that one of two states where the governor claims an exemption, at least up until now. Mm-hmm. Thanks to Todd Wallach, formerly at the Globe, he deserves the credit. He's now at BUR. Todd Wallach wrote relentlessly at the Globe about how we were the only state in the United States where the legislature, the judiciary, and the governor's office, all three, claimed an exemption from public records laws in progressive Massachusetts, and it's a disgrace. It really is a total disgrace in that they contort themselves into pretzels when they make these arguments as to why we wouldn't understand what was going on in a committee hearing.
Right.
It's better we get a summary. It is just total BS.
Well, talk
good
about,
for Healey and good for Todd Wallach.
Talk about, because you guys know this better than I do, talk about the way they have these committee meetings up on Beacon Hill that are just closed to everybody.
Right.
And sometimes they don't even reveal how they voted.
Right. And it's so important that we get fixes on this because, I mean, I think, you know, a democracy dies in darkness, as the Washington Post says, and it's really true. You know, the other thing that's related to this that your listeners should really know about is that one of the few good things that happened during the COVID pandemic's height was that we had local town meetings and school board meetings that were virtually available and hybrid available, and there's sort of a move now to make them not available anymore. And the ACLU and other transparency groups are really pushing that this should be the law, that they should be hybrid at all times. Because think about the people who can participate in their democracy, but they need to make dinner. They can't get childcare. They can't get parking. They can't get down there. But if they can tune in from their home and be part of the participating in our democracy, we get a stronger democracy and more public participation. And I think this is one of the things that the ACLU is going to be pushing for the legislature to make sure stays in place.
And you know what else? They could lie to you and tell you they were talking about personnel when they weren't. But these local town meetings, if you're there as a reporter or as a regular right. citizen, mm-hmm. they're supposed to be conducting all their business in public.
Right.
And they can only go into executive sessions, so-called, when they go hide behind the curtains right. or whatever under certain circumstances. Again, they could be lying. But it does make it harder for them.
The lying part I don't like, because let me just say, when I was a city councilor in Cambridge,
all you did was
there are two things we did in when we went into executive session. The only two things we ever did is, one, we discussed personal matters, right. and two, we discussed what we were ordering from the SNS deli. Those were only on the taxpayers, yeah. by the way,
they
on their dime.
They had a huge buffet for the SNS deli.
That is private.
That was really private, trust
me. And the SNS
me.
Deli, I'm sure that they benefited from that. They were very grateful to
have it. It was good for democracy, good for a local small business.
Cambridge right. City Council.
And by the way, it was not coincidence that when I was on the city council, every one of the 9 city councilors would come with shopping bags to the meeting, and it was not to take home their preparation. So, you know, one last question about this. I'm embarrassed to say, even though I care a lot about it, I'm not sure I understand operationally. What will be the first evidence what is an example of evidence mm-hmm. that Healey is no longer claiming an exemption? What might you or the Boston Globe, just give me a hypothetical,
might.
Ask for that Charlie Baker or Mitt Romney or Deval Patrick might have said no to that Governor Healey might? What will this give us access yeah. to that we would otherwise not have? What kind of thing?
You know, that's a really good question. Let me give it a thought.
Okay.
You know, part of it is I'm thinking, you know, there could be things that are happening. You know, I know that we've had to file lawsuits over things like racial disparities and stop and frisk patterns in state police. Those kinds of things. You know, you want to be able to get that stuff and not have to go to litigation.
An executive branch thing. Okay.
Executive branch.
Okay,
thing.
Fine.
Right. So think
okay.
about executive branch stuff.
Fair enough.
Okay. So tell us what's going on in the sheriff's office down in Barnstable in terms of
wow.
there's been a change of sheriffs.
Yes.
And regarding cooperating with ICE
yes.
to send immigrants who may not be here legally to ICE.
Right. So, I mean, this is part of the ACLU's and our allies groups, our voter education campaign around Know Your Sheriff, right? Because we realized that the vast majority of people, we just didn't know who our sheriffs were or what sheriffs actually do, right? And if you don't know, you tend not to vote. People will just leave it blank or they'll just be an incumbent. And so this last round, we did a Know Your Sheriff campaign, and we increased by in double figures across the Commonwealth, the number of people who were participating
That's
in
great.
That.
Really? Yeah.
Really
good for you.
Right. So it was really great, and it brought to the attention the role that the sheriffs play. And one of the big roles that sheriffs play has to do with detention of immigrants, right? And so when these sheriffs have gone in with ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, the federal enforcement agency that comes in, they allow themselves to be deputized as federal ICE agents. And as a result, what happens when you have local law enforcement working for ICE, then people who are undocumented, who might be victims of a crime or witnesses to a crime or anything like that, they're afraid to come forward and to talk to law enforcement, local law enforcement, because they feel like, well, you're not really protecting my community. You're really working for the federal government. And these things, the 287G agreements, they're called, they really expanded under the Trump administration when there were not enough immigration officials to separate all those children and their parents that the Trump administration wanted to do. And so by entering into these 287 agreements, it was giving power to local police to actually be deputized as ICE agents. So getting rid of them has been tremendously important. And it was so wonderful to see that the newly elected Barnstable Sheriff, Donna Buckley, actually ended the 287G agreement, which means here in Massachusetts, that was the last one among all the sheriff's offices.
It had been Plymouth County, Barnstable, and Bristol.
Bristol.
And Hodgson, Sheriff Hodgson, who is best known and accused of mm-hmm. treating immigrants very badly, he was beaten by Paul Heroux, I think the former mayor of Attleboro.
Yep.
So we assume that things are changing down there as well.
Right, right. And that 287G agreement got not renewed already.
Okay.
So, you know, this is really actually quite good news, because I think it's important that if we want to have an immigration system, and I think everybody agrees that it's broken and needs to be fixed, one way to do that isn't to scare people from going forward if they're a victim or a witness to a crime.
So there were 3 counties that did this voluntarily. 3 mm-hmm. sheriffs chose to end the policy. Rather than leaving it to the whim of individual sheriffs and sort of the,
yeah.
to me, absurdity that in one county you can do this and a mile over you can't.
Right.
Could the legislature not statewide say that
yes.
no sheriff may participate in such an agreement?
Absolutely.
So
we think they should. That's going to be another bill that's going to be introduced to the legislature. Because, again, like you're saying, we don't want to leave it to the whims of an individual sheriff to decide whether to do that. And also the Department of Corrections still has one here in Massachusetts, the last in New England. So
They still have such an agreement?
Mm-hmm, they do. And so what we want to do is to make sure that the Department of Correction also doesn't have a 287G
Has Healy been asked about this during the campaign, do you know, or in her week in office or whatever it is?
Okay. I don't know. Okay. It's a good question, though.
So what is the ACLU's agenda for 2023 up in the Beacon Hill?
Well, we have a really exciting agenda. So first and foremost, between now and 2024, the biggest thing we're going to be working on is strengthening democracy. And that has to do with voting registration, get out the vote, getting people, training people up as poll watchers. And, you know, we're a nonpartisan organization, so, you know, we don't actually get involved in the in candidates, but we do get involved in democracy. So we really want people to participate. That goes also to the virtual meetings. So there's a whole suite of things we're going to be policy changes that we want to push to make sure that our democracy gets stronger between now and 2024 in the election.
Like what?
Like voter registration and virtual meetings and things like that.
How hard is it to get poll watchers? I would think in this climate it might be increasingly difficult.
It's hard, and we need a new generation. So we really want to be focusing on a next generation of people, because one of the things we've learned is that when people get involved in their democracy, it gets stronger against those who would actually have authoritarian tendencies. So that's the first thing, is a democracy agenda. The second thing has to do with reproductive rights and reproductive justice. So we work in the Choice Coalition to make sure that people have access, and we want to protect both patients and providers. And we passed the legislature passed a wonderful bill here in Massachusetts at the end of the session that expanded a lot of protections and really made Massachusetts a leader nationwide. But the one place that we still see a hole that needs to be filled has to do with cybersecurity privacy protections. And so things, for example, you don't want a bounty hunter from Texas being able to track somebody here in Massachusetts and find out where they went, a patient who might come here or a provider, and then try to get a bounty by trying to prosecute them. So there are privacy protections that we're going to be proposing to put into place to make sure that reproductive rights are protected not just in law, but in reality.
Who opposes that on Beacon Hill? Why wasn't that part of the earlier package? I mean, it seems like a no-brainer, a term I can't stand. I don't know why I used it. But why isn't it a given?
So what we're going to, the way you do it, Jim, is going to be putting a ban on the sale of data location, right? And so there are some companies that profit from it. And so what we're going to have to do is to educate legislators to understand. It's one thing if you like give your data to Google Maps or Waze or whatever, because that they're using it for the reasons you gave it to them. But they shouldn't be able to turn around and then sell it or give it to some random person in Texas or wherever who wants to track and get a bounty on somebody here. Right.
You know, speaking of democracy for a second, I think we've had this discussion with you before, and I know it falls outside of your jurisdiction because it is partisan politics. I am of the belief the biggest threat to democracy in Massachusetts is that there's one party in Massachusetts. There are a handful, several handfuls of Republicans on Beacon Hill. I think it's three or four. It's a very small number in the Senate. Mm-hmm. It's 20-something. I may be off by a little. But it's a pathetic minority that can't essentially do anything.
Right.
Because they're so outnumbered.
Right.
So why can't you do a Know Your Legislator campaign, just like you've done Know Your Sheriff, Know Your DA, to get more people involved in electoral politics so there's more balance?
That's a great idea. No, I think it's a great idea. I think, you know, knowledge is power, and so knowledge in the hands of the voters is power, is people power. Yeah. And that's the kind of thing we're looking for, the Judicial Nominating Council, you know, those kinds of things. We're going to be doing a lot more of this voter education and engagement because we think that's really good. And the last thing I just have to say, really important and should be a housekeeping detail at the beginning of the legislature, is to, for once and all, pass common sense regulations on the use of face and biometric surveillance.
What's the status of that?
So there's a commission that came out. It was unanimous. I mean, how often do you have the Mass State Police and the AG's office and the ACLU and everybody else on the same page? So it just didn't make it in the final rush at the end of the session. It just didn't get passed, and it should be passed just at the very beginning as a housekeeping matter, because you really don't want to have a situation like we do in some places in China, for example, where a bad government agent gets into power, and it may be in 10 years or 20 years, like you don't know what's going to happen, and they could track everywhere we go, and you can't, you know, you can leave your cell phone at home if you don't want to be tracked by your cell phone pings. You can't leave your face or your gait or your earlobes at home. And those are the kinds of things that if we don't put in the restrictions right now, and there's consensus that we should do it, then our grandchildren will say, where were you?
Why'd you say earlobes?
Because that's one of the things that are a unique identifier.
Really?
Yep.
Because people's earlobes are so varied?
Yeah. So, you know, and you can't change those things, right? So what we're saying is that, and we know that these kind of technologies.
I think it's bigger if you wear big earrings for many, many years.
Going to stretch.
Yeah, I think it will stretch
out.
Good
luck with that, Mark.
Or they closed during the pandemic because you didn't wear earrings for 3 years.
But we don't want to make everybody responsible for that.
That's right. Okay.
No, so I just think that, you know, passing the recommendations of the face surveillance committee, of the face recognition committee, would just be the common sense thing to do. And honestly, it is. It's such an existent, such a serious threat to our democracy and to our liberty. And yet people say, well, you know, it's not a problem yet. And then when it's too late, they go, well, now it's too late. Well, now is the right time. This is the Goldilocks moment, and we should pass the commission's report.
And we should say something nice. Your colleague, Kate Crockford, who's been with us, has done great work on this. You
know,
we're going to have the guy from Forbidden Stories with us in about, I don't know, 20 minutes or something. Mm-hmm. who is responsible for coordinating all the work on Pegasus. And for those out there who don't know what Pegasus is, it's a software program created by something called the NSO Group. It's an Israeli-based organization that is sold to governments, theoretically, to track criminals and terrorists. But as Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon said, it's the go-to spy service for tyrants. Mm-hmm. They use that.
Absolutely.
They make a really, incredible case. There are dead journalists, dead other leaders and other people because of the spyware. There's zero regulation.
That's right.
Of this. Is it because legislators just can't stay caught up with the technology?
Yes, it is.
Is that what it is?
Well, yeah, and also they bring up the threat, the law and order thing, you know. And so part what we have to remember.
But you're going to stop us from going after the terrorists.
But we're
and
not,
criminals.
And that's why these common sense kinds of regulations, like get a warrant. I mean, it's not that it doesn't prevent law enforcement from doing the job to keep us safe, but it does prevent tyrants and authoritarian governments from using it to track people or to blackmail their opponents or to, you know, otherwise target people. And it's happening in other countries. So we need to act now. And here in Massachusetts, you know, we've been the leader on so many things. We were talking about reproductive justice and equal marriage and all these other things. We've been such a leader on that. We need to also be a leader and continue to be a leader on the privacy front against the so we get the benefits of the new technologies that are coming out, but we mitigate the harms.
You know, one last question about sort of a pro-democracy, pro-freedom agenda, et cetera. Marjorie and I began talking last week about a bill the Mass Teachers Association is advancing, which she and I powerfully disagree on. They want public employees, other than public safety public employees, to have a right to strike, as every private sector union has. I don't know if every. The vast majority of private sector unions do in the United States. That's not on your list.
It's not on our list.
Why wouldn't it be? Why wouldn't the right of a worker to be able to strike, even if the argument of a Marjorie Egan is the students suffer,
well,
but a lot of people suffer.
But let's point out, they do strike, and then they pay fines.
Well, I understand
so
that,
it's not
but
like
that's
they
not legal.
Strike.
They're breaking the law to do it.
They're breaking
they would
the
like
law,
to not break the law.
But no one's arresting anybody. They break the law, and they pay a fine.
Why would that not be something that you guys...
Well, you know, the ACLU's position is clearly in favor of the right to collective bargaining. I don't know specifically what the contours of the argument are on this one, but I'll take a look at it, and happy
Good.
To talk to you next time.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, Carol Rose, thank you very much.
Nice
actually,
to see you.
As people are coming
oh, they're coming right
minutes.
Now. You're right. I'm
yes,
sorry.
I'm very
it's not
excited
20
about
minutes.
That. Happy New Year, Carol Rose. Glad to see you as always. Carol Rose is Executive Director of the American Civil Liberties Union of Massachusetts.
Thanks, Carol.
And we thank her for her time. Coming up, a new, really disturbing two-part frontline series exposes the powerful spyware tool we were just mentioning, Pegasus, and how the hacking tool was used to spy on journalists, activists, the fiancé and the wife of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi, who was, of course, murdered, and others. We'll hear from the director, Laurent Richard. He's next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library, and we are streaming on youtube.com/GBHnews.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News. If the spy software known as Pegasus sounds familiar, you may be remembering reports from July of 2021 that French President Macron's phone had been hacked using it. The group that makes the Pegasus software, it's Israel's NSO group, has strongly denied those allegations. And there's a lot that NSO has publicly denied over the past few years, the least of which is being that their software was used by dictators to target and even kill journalists and peaceful activists alike. It's all highlighted in a brilliant must-see new two-part Frontline series, Global Spyware Scandal, Exposing Pegasus, the second of which airs tonight on GBH2 at 10 p.m. It's also streaming at PBS Passport. Laurent Richard is the director of the series, also the founder and executive director of Forbidden Stories, a network of journalists that aims to protect, pursue, and publish the work of other journalists facing threats, prison, or murder. He joins us now on Zoom. It's great to meet you, and congratulations on really, really important work. Thank you.
Hi, thank you for having me. And just to be precise, I'm not the director of the series. I'm one of the producers of the series. Yes.
Okay.
But thank you so much for having me.
Our pleasure.
So expand a little bit on what Pegasus is and why it is such a scary way to get into people's phones and computers, et cetera.
Well, Pegasus is a spyware. That means it's a software that is able to take entirely the control of your device. It's like basically a person over your shoulder will watch what you are watching, read what are you reading, even your encrypted messages. Once you are infected, you're trapped. You are entirely trapped because this spyware is transferring your secrets, your intimacy, all your life to your worst enemies, the people who are surveilling you, the people who want to collect intelligence and information from you to maybe one day use that kind of information against you. So this is why it's a threat for the democracy, and we should be, all of us, very worried about that, because we have been able to discover a global misuse of that spyware all around the world with the thousands of victims.
Now, NSO, the organization that created this software in Israel, it appears to have a very close relationship with the man who just returned to the prime minister chair, Netanyahu. They said, we sell to governments. We sell to governments to allow them to expose terrorists and criminals. They deny, even though they refused to talk to you, the founder did talk to you, they deny virtually every other serious allegation that is made. The one point, it seems to me, that they have is there's great value in at least what the intended purpose is. I assume you'd agree with that, correct?
Yes. So it's true when they say that they only say that to state actors. The thing is that is to the question is more about to what kind of state actors do they sell this spyware to? When you start to sell this spyware to the Saudis, to the government of Azerbaijan, to dictatorship, you know from the very beginning how they will use that. They will use that, as we were able to confirm, to track the dissidents, to track journalists, to track lawyers, political opponents, and so on. So this is why there is the lack of regulation in the topic we're talking about, our privacy, our dignity. How do we know that we could be the target tomorrow of that? And if we are the victim, what we can do after that? It's a huge issue. And I think with that serial frontline, we are able to show how 80 journalists from 16 news organizations all over the world decided to be united and to work together on something extremely explosive and extremely sensitive to reveal for the very first time since the Snowden revelation the real faces of the victims of the cyber surveillance, the real names, people who could be your neighbor, that could be you tomorrow, so we could all be the next one on the list.
You know, repeat what you just, elaborate on what you just said about the journalists all working together. These were from the Washington Post and the Guardian and Le Monde in Paris. I mean, the group is quite large.
Yes, that's what we call collaborative journalism. And I really personally think that's the future of journalism. Future of journalism is collaboration. Why? Because collaboration first is bringing protection. Doesn't make sense to kill a reporter if you know that there are 79 other reporters ready to continue the work. And this is what Forbidden Stories is about. We are most of the time continuing the work of assassinated or jailed or under threat reporters. But collaboration is bringing a lot of resources, financial resources, but also much more value for the public opinion. We have 80 reporters fact-checking every single sentence in every single piece. And much more impact, of course, because you have 16 news organizations publishing at once, at the same time, stories all around the world for a topic that is real threats for our global democracy.
You know, by the way, I should say one of the reasons why this film, both installments, are so compelling is not just because of the subject matter. The brilliance, and maybe it was yours, Laurent, to start filming in real time when all of you started working together. So we're following with you. As, for example, one of the scenes that I will never forget, there are millions, is when you get 50,000 phone numbers, and obviously job number one is to match them to individuals. One of the matches you believed was the president of France, Macron. So explain what your colleagues did to find out whether or not it in fact was President Macron's phone.
Yeah, as I said, at the very beginning, so we start to film everything because we were having the feeling, the impression that we were really living in a thriller. And we should film that as it happens, because we were having 50,000 phone numbers of person of interest potentially targeted by the most dangerous states in the world, by dozens of intelligence services. And when you have that kind of list in within your hand, first, the first thing you think is say, it might be very stupid to be the only one to have that in my hand. So you need to share that. And so both organization, Amnesty International and Forbidden Stories, were granted access to that list. And we decided to set up a huge collaboration. And then one of the very first tasks was to, okay, we were having only phone numbers, but who are behind those phone numbers? We wanted to have answers to that, to have names. So with the work of Amnesty International Security Lab, they were able, and we were doing that with them, to ID people, to identify numbers and to find names. And this is how, at some point, the very first thing we did was to cross-check with our own contact phone list, with our own directory. And this is how I see some people, even some friends of mine who were on that list. And this is how we saw as well the phone number, one of the phone numbers actually of the President Macron. What happened then with the President Macron phone number, we don't know exactly. We still don't have the truth on that because there is no transparency. We don't know. We know that the phone number was his phone number. We know that his phone number was on the list. But we don't know if he was really hacked or infected because the French president doesn't want to communicate and doesn't want to be transparent on that. We know for sure that members of the governments were effectively infected by Pegasus, but this information is still classified in France about Macron.
But we should say that the first step there was some of your colleagues texted the phone number, essentially texted Macron to find out, and shortly thereafter, while he himself didn't respond, the government did respond, summoning your colleagues.
They
trucked
him
to
down
them.
To Elysee Palace.
It was
like,
pretty
what,
great.
Within 2 hours?
It was pretty great.
It went quite fast. It was the journalist from Le Monde, Damien and Martin, who were sending a text message to just the French president, and 2 hours later, someone who is the head of the political desk at Le Monde received another text message from the Élysée, from the entourage of Macron, say, one guy of your team just sent a very strange text message to the president, and we need to talk urgently about that.
We're talking with Laurent Richard. He's a producer of Frontline's latest two-part series, Global Spyware Scandal, Exposing Pegasus. The second part of it airs tonight on Channel 2 on GBH at 10 o'clock. So you give a lot of examples of where Pegasus was used in a nefarious way. Tell us about the involvement of Pegasus in the murder of the Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi, who was cut into pieces and taken out of the embassy, the Saudi embassy, in suitcases, the involvement of him and his wife and fiance.
Yes, absolutely, because that's so what the serial Frontline is revealing is how people around Jamal, before and after his killing, were targeted by this spyware called Pegasus. And so we don't have any evidence that Jamal himself was targeted. We don't say that. We don't know that. What we do know is what we were able to see through forensic analysis. And forensic analysis run by Amnesty International Security Lab. We were doing some peer review by Citizen Lab, another organization involved in that kind of investigation into the spy war. We're able to confirm that they find traces of infection on both the fiancé of Jamal and the wife of Jamal. And the two women have been infected. So that means that the Saudis were likely targeting the entourage of Jamal to get information about him. We don't know how far and what have been collected, what kind of information, but we were able to reveal something that NSO was denying firmly. The CEO of NSO, Shadeh Bouyo, was, after the killing of Jamal, went on CBS 60 Minutes to explain that the spy war have never been used against Jamal or his relatives. And we were able to prove that this was a lie. He was lying on that.
By the way, if people think that when both Laurent and Marjorie are saying Khashoggi's fiancé and wife, that they're misspeaking, it in fact was his fiancé and his
well, you call
wife
it
legally.
A complicated personal life, I think is the way you put it very euphemistically.
Yeah,
you
complicated
know,
life.
You yes. know, even though you just said, you know, you didn't use these terms, but you can't connect all the dots. All you can report is what you were factually able to ascertain.
Yeah.
You made the case in terms of Mexico, where 15,000 of these phone numbers came with, at least for me as a viewer, that another journalist by the name of Pineda probably is dead because of this Pegasus software. Was I drawing too much of a conclusion there?
Yeah, it's a bit too much, honestly, because we don't have that evidence. What we saw is that the phone numbers of that journalist, Cecilio Pineda, was added to the list a few weeks before his killing. But we were not able to run some forensic investigation into the device of Cecilio Pineda because we were not able to mm-hmm. get the device. So we don't make the connection between the killing and the spy war. At least what is very interesting, because we should not be naive in the same time, that when you see that kind of the entourage of Jamal, the name of a murdered, slain report, Mexican reporters in that list. You have an idea about, okay, what kind of targets, what kind of person are targeted with that kind of spy war? Is that matching with the narrative of NSO, who is officially saying that we only say that to catch the bad guys? Mm-hmm. Cecilio Pineda was not a bad guy. He was not a terrorist. He was not a criminal. He was a journalist. Jamal Khashoggi was not a terrorist. He was a journalist. And so on. Khadija Ismailova, she's a journalist, and she was highly infected, highly targeted, and we were able to prove that. So the thing is about that kind of lies. And I think for the very first time, this investigation is really about that. Putting on the table evidences, scientific evidences, where we show the public opinion how dangerous the situation is when you don't have any regulation, any mechanism to protect us against that kind of attack.
You know, you also told a very upsetting story about Princess Latifa of Dubai, who was trying to escape. She was under, I guess, house arrest by her father, and she successfully escaped, but then it didn't work out. Let's play a little sound from the smartphone footage that she recorded from inside her home/jail cell in Dubai.
This villa has been converted into a jail. All the windows are barred shut. I can't open any window. There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. I don't know what can happen to me and how long this will last, and if they decide to release me, like how my life will be. But I'm not safe at all.
Tell us.
Repeat, that's the daughter of the president.
That's the daughter of the president, right. And she is a captive in her own home. But tell us about the relationship between her and Pegasus. What happened?
What happened is that the spyware were used against people around her. So that's not actually a new tactic. Intelligence people, they are always doing that. When they want to collect evidence on the head of state or on a person of interest, they don't want to take too much risk in leaving some traces on high figures. So what do they do is that they will target the driver, they will target the cardiologist, the doctor, the entourage, all the employees around the person. And this is what happened to the princess as well, that we saw that phone numbers of people of her entourage, even her lawyer, were targeted, were on the list, or some of them were targeted with that kind of spyware. So again, that's the question of, you have a private company selling a weapon to state actors, and there is no transparency, no accountability, no regulation. And we talk here about military weapon. Pegasus is a spyware that requires a military license to be exported, delivered by the Ministry of Defense of Israel. And it's classified as a weapon. So we talk about military weapons used against civilians. And this is what happened when you see the Princess Latifah and all the entourage being targeted or being exposed to that kind of spyware, and you don't have any kind of control on that.
We're talking to Laurent Richard from Forbidden Stories, one of the leaders and a producer of this film, leaders of this joint journalism effort that culminated in this two-part Frontline series, the second of which airs tonight at 10 on Channel 2, Global Spyware Scandal Exposing Pegasus.
Just to wrap up this Princess Latifah story, though, as I understand it from your reporting, she orchestrated this pretty elaborate escape from Dubai and was successful. She got out.
Almost.
And then she gets on this yacht.
Yeah.
To go to India, was it? To India she was going?
Yeah, and the Indian Coast Guard was able, they went to her and they harassed her. So she was in the middle of the ocean and some Coast Guard were arresting her. So that's a failed escape, yeah.
And she was brought back to Dubai to her imprisonment.
Yeah.
I mean, horrible.
Laurent, I'm not clear on what the state of things is in the United States. We mentioned before to the head of the Civil Liberties Union here that Ron Wyden, who's the United States Senator from Oregon, said that Pegasus is the go-to spy service for tyrants. He says that in your film. We also know that the head of the FBI testified in front of Congress, essentially, that other than for research purposes, they had nothing to do with Pegasus, which was later proven to be untrue. Mm. Do we know what the status of the United States government's involvement with Pegasus is?
Yeah. So we know different things. The first thing is that so we know from the New York Times investigation that the FBI was at some point interested and has been able to test Pegasus spyware. But just as a test phase, and the language of the FBI say that we try to deploy it and to test it, but not to use it. So the FBI was interested by the spyware, and by some, we don't know if it's for sure Pegasus or another kind of spyware, but it was within the NSO group. Then what we know as well is that NSO has always said that there is no way for any kind of NSO customer to target a plus one number. And so when you are, NSO is having different kind of commercial contracts based on customers. If you sell to that country, you can let that country attack only citizens of their own country, or another country will be able to attack 10 other countries. So you have to pay more to infect more, if you want to infect more. We know for sure that NSO has that kind of policy that it was not possible for any kind of state, any kind of customers to attack or to target, to infect a plus one phone number. What we know for sure is that the Commerce Department, the U.S. authorities, after the publication of the Pegasus project, have decided to blacklist the NSO group. So to make sure it would be impossible for any kind of US-based entity to contract with the NSO group. So that was a very, very impactful decision from a country, because that kind of decision really was extremely damaging, impactful for the business model of the NSO group.
You know, one of the things I don't understand that we were talking again to the head of the Civil Liberties Union here about the lack of regulation. You have to explain to me why it isn't happening. You have some pretty powerful moments from a leader of the NSO getting grilled by members of EU's parliament. And the first voice you'll hear is the guy from NSO defending the company's standards. This is vis-a-vis Hungary, which people know is led by Orban, friend of Trump. Here is his voice and then some questioners. Here it is.
We have not said that we have determined recently that Hungary is or is not a secure country.
You did consider it secure
I said now.
Let's keep a little bit of order in the meeting as well. I understand there is frustration, but you have the concrete question. We have a concrete answer. And please.
So you keep repeating the same thing, and there seems to be a complete disconnect between reality and between what you're saying. This is like, you know, it's an insult to our intelligence. Sorry.
You watch your film and there is a complete disconnect between reality and what the company is saying. Why has there been such little progress on the regulatory front?
That's a very important question, because the NSO can only sell that kind of spyware. So they sell this spyware to military units. And when they do sell that to a customer, they will say, I'm selling you the device, I'm selling you the weapon, I'm selling you the gun, but I don't know who you will be dealing with, who you will be targeting. And I don't want to know about you. And there is no way for me as NSO, as the sales guys and the seller of that, to know who you will be your target. So that's why NSO now is always in that situation where they say, we cannot reveal the identity of the target, and we cannot reveal even the identity of our customers per contract. So this is the two main points. First is how you can control the misuse of the spyware that you are selling if you have no way to investigate the identity of the target targeted by your spyware. How you do that? So it's a very difficult question. The second question is that, as a country, I think as a citizen, we need to know if our government is using that kind of spyware. We know how intrusive, how aggressive it is, and how impactful it could be for victims of that spyware if they are not terrorists or criminals, and if they are only journalists or lawyers or human rights activists. So we need, I think, that's maybe more than journalism that I'm delivering here, but I think we need a kind of mechanism where we need in our society some people in charge, whether it's about to the Congress people to ask this kind of question, to get that access to that kind of classified information. Do my country is using Pegasus? Who is in charge of controlling the targets and the potential misuse of that? And if that's the case, how do we stop a contract with that kind of company? And for the company, if you are a company selling that kind of spyware, are you able to sell the spyware to any kind of countries, or do we have to set up a kind of blacklist of countries that you should not sell that because you don't have any kind of guarantee about the way they will use it?
Well, correct me if I misunderstand, but I thought one of the problems here is that you have a little talk by Benjamin Netanyahu, newly reelected to the head of Israel, who's talked about how he wants very low taxes and very low regulation on a lot of these companies to make a lot of money. And so that would seem to be part of the reason anyway why NSO is not regulated heavily.
Yeah, that's the lack of regulation, the lack of tax is exactly what they wanted. And this is where they are, actually. And this is why it's a very lucrative business. And this is why there are so many Pegasus in the world, and not only one NSO, but many other companies who are the competitors of NSO. And this is why we should be very worried about, because no regulation, a lot of companies, and we have a lot of governments, non-transparent governments or oppressive regime, ready to pay millions to exploit one device like your phone you have. So this is where we are. So the cyber industry, Benjamin Netanyahu is really one of the pioneers of that industry. He wanted Israel to become the country who would take the lead on that. Yeah. And that's a country extremely successful in military solution. And the thing is with NSO, you have a company with two salesmen, extremely extremely good actually in selling something to a product to someone. The thing is more about ethics and policy, human rights policy, and how do you control that? So, and I think that after the publication of the Pegasus project, there were a lot of meetings within the industry to think about, okay, what do we learn from that kind of misuse from the Pegasus spyware, and should we continue selling that kind of spyware to the Saudis and the others? I don't know yet the answers. I just know that there were some questions and conversation about that, but clearly there is a lack of information about the regulation going on in that kind of industry.
Laurent, congratulations to you and your colleagues for this incredibly spectacular film and years of work. Thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank
you. Congratulations on this work. We've been speaking with Laurent.
You've got to watch the second portion tonight.
It's very
go back and watch
disturbing.
The first.
He is a producer with Frontline's latest two-part series, Global Spyware Scandal Exposing Pegasus. As Jim said, the second part airs on GBH2 tonight at 10, and you can stream both parts on PBS Passport. And thanks again to Laurent for his time. Okay, coming up, what all you people on YouTube are waiting for here, you definitely know this gentleman from his life as a member of New Kids on the Block, but Jordan Knight is making a name for himself in the restaurant world, too, with the recently reopened Novara in Milton. He'll join us alongside the co-owner of that restaurant, Vance Welch. They are next. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 GBH. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library, and we are streaming on youtube.com/GBHnews.
Trusted. Local. News. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, HD1 Boston, online at gbhnews.org. GBH News with NPR. What matters to you.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBHnews. So toward the end of last year, Milton's Navarra restaurant closed after a two-alarm kitchen fire. Luckily, no one was hurt. Now in the new year, Navarra's back open, and its co-owners are here at the Boston Public Library with beautiful-looking food.
Oh,
this actually
God.
Begins the Dorchester section of our show. John King is going to join us from CNN in 20 minutes. But first, Dorchester's own Jordan Knight, a relatively new kid in the restaurant business, and Vance Welch, managing partner of Navarra and Abbey Park. Welcome to both of you.
Hey, thanks for having
us. Now, Vance, before we start, I want to read some of the posts on YouTube, obviously about you. He's an amazing man. He is magical, listening from Denmark. And this one is really a tribute to you, Vance. I'm waiting for my baby daddy to come on TikTok. How did you become so
Vance.
Popular, Vance?
What
it's incredible. It's really amazing.
Okay. Well,
Vance is turning red now, like Trenny did an hour ago, I should say.
Well, we did have a very embarrassing moment with Trenny Casey, who is our sports analyst, came in here and just about died when you came over and talked to her, because she's been a New Kids on the Block fan forever and a day. But people do know you for your fame with your brother and the other band members, but you are also now in the restaurant business. So how'd that happen?
It kind of happened by luck. Me and my wife, we moved to Milton maybe 20 years ago or whatever. There was actually no restaurants in Milton, it seemed like. And we had to travel far and wide to go to a restaurant. And there was a restaurant that opened up, Abbey Park, which was in East Milton Square, and we started going to that regularly. And the food was great, the service was great, and we found out that Vance was owner and operator of that restaurant. And we got to know Vance, and the food was always consistent and everything. And there was some construction going on a couple buildings away, And, you know, I started to ask Vance, like, what's going on over there? He said, oh, we're doing a new restaurant. And I was like, oh, that's really exciting. And later on, we talked about me being an investor, and he showed me the space. And I thought it was, like, just what Milton needed. One thing I was nervous about was, it really was, because Milton didn't have, like, a kind of, like, a cool place, kind of like... It seems like something you would go to in the South End or downtown or something like that, but it was in the suburbs. And he showed me the spot, and then I was like, but there's a restaurant like two doors down. And I was wondering, you know, why he was doing it. And then I was looking, and I said, well, there's a Starbucks there, and there's a Dunkin' Donuts there, and they're both busy, so I guess it'll work. So, and I knew Vance, you know, ran a tight ship, and the same executive chef was going to be working at the new restaurant. So I jumped aboard, and you know, I really feel like, you know, I got lucky by, you know, meeting Vance by happenstance and through my wife, actually. She really kind of pushed the idea.
So, Vance, I've been to Abbey Park. It's great, by the way. Is this fabulous? Were you nervous? I'm serious about having somebody who had no involvement in the restaurant business other than liking good food as a partner.
No, I mean, I think Jordan brings a lot to the table for us. He's
so to speak. Very thank you very much. Yes.
Yeah. So, no, not at all. I mean, we knew Jordan, and we, you know, we became friends over the years, and that's no.
Before we talk about the food,
we have to find out. If, you know, like I said before, Trini Casey comes in here; she's beside herself. I mean, this must happen. This happened to you many times, I'm sure, over your career, that people see you or they recognize you, and they're all excited. Mm-hmm. But you know, I mean, are people knocking on the window, seeing, finding out if the new kids are going to be playing in the back patio or anything? I mean, do you get a lot of starstruck young kids and older kids looking for them?
Our share of fans.
Yeah, I bet you do.
Hey, Vance, how did you make it through the pandemic? I mean, you've been around. How was that? I mean, we've talked to a lot of restaurateurs here, some of whom didn't survive, many of whom survived literally by a shoestring. And how did it go for you? What'd you do?
Well, we got creative with takeout, and that's something that became almost like another business for us. It's something that we never closed down. We went right back to work.
But then you have a COVID, you survive that, and then you have a fire, which has got to be so. Well, you're the partner in the business there, Jordan. I mean, how depressing is that to a small business guy?
It was, it was scary to know that the place caught on fire. I drove down there, and luckily it was, you know, one of the fryer-laters somehow caught on fire, and there was like, I guess. The fryolators have a chute to take the flames if they do catch on fire? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it got caught up in a ventilation system.
So, but it went up through the vent, and it, like, burned a hole in the roof. And, you know, the fire trucks were there, and I'm like, oh, my goodness, you know. So I walked in. I saw Vance in there, and he was walking around. And most of all, it was, like, smoky, and there was just water everywhere, and there was basically a hole in the roof, and you know, luckily for us, Milton Fire came really quick and put it out. But yeah, for a small business, it's probably the most devastating thing that can happen, and luckily it wasn't too awful.
Okay, so we're not going to let him describe the food. We're going to let the investor describe the food. What are these mushroom things I'm eating?
Oh,
you know what?
I've never had
the mushrooms.
They're
but
really good.
I swear.
What's this thing right here?
Tuna poke.
Am I talking to you, Vance, or am I talking to this guy?
I mean, I don't eat
tuna. You don't eat that either. You don't eat the mushrooms. You don't eat the tuna.
No, but I guarantee you they're good. I eat the chicken parm. I eat these.
Chicken parm. Absolutely.
And what's that over there?
Chicken parm meatballs, actually.
Chicken parm meatballs, okay.
What is that, Vance? I've had that the other day.
That's what I'm taking home, Jim.
See, I'm not a foodie.
That's pretty apparent. You know what I mean here?
But I like the food.
That's the short ribs.
I had that two nights ago.
Can you pass that over in this direction?
Kind of, this is kind of Italian. Is it Italian
kind
cuisine?
Of.
Now,
Thank you.
I know the other place is more American,
yeah.
But this new place is more Italian, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, you don't look Italian, and the name Welch is not particularly Italian. So where do you get off doing the Italian food thing?
Well, our culinary partner, Tony Dorenzo, he was the chef that we opened with, and he's... He's Italian.
And his and his grandmother taught him how to cook when he was a young boy, and she's from Italy.
Is a mother, a grandmother still helping out in the restaurant? Did I read that somewhere?
Yeah, she had been. She used to make all our meatballs.
So it's the real deal.
Yeah,
Italian.
So why is Italian, I mean, it's like every time you turn around, you know, people love Italian restaurants. I mean, I love Italian restaurants. So what is it about Italian food? Are you Irish?
I'm Irish.
There's not many Irish food places, Vince, are there?
No, there is not.
No, there's not very many. There's not many at all. So, Vince, what's wrong with the Irish food? What's great about the Italian food?
I don't know. I think that we would have to...
Yeah?
I mean, I think that if you look at the Italian foods that are on the menu, they've been popularized here as more American, Italian-American. And that's pretty much the core of our menu.
You know, we're trying to have a serious discussion about a restaurant that
I was
just reopened, survived COVID.
Baked potatoes.
No, wait a second. Before you get to baked potatoes, here's Tracy. Public radio has never been more popular. It's a little insulting to us. Here is Hungry for Jordan with a couple of emojis. And from Sao Paulo, Brazil, his voice, oh, my God, I melt every time. I mean, this is on. I mean... Yeah, I mean, it's really... Can I tell you what we have?
What?
Because, by the way, obviously your goal is to get people in your restaurant. And one of the promotions you did was fabulous, fans. We have a photograph, actually some video.
Yes, right there.
Of Jordan at the... Here he is at the restaurant.
Yeah.
Now, why did you decide...
It gets hot in the restaurant.
So that's why you decided to take your shirt off, right?
Yeah. With all the, you know... The cooking that's going on.
Exactly.
And that's me rubbing my belly because I just had a great meal. I think salmon piccata was what I ate before I did that number there.
Well, you're looking pretty good.
But Jordan, you know, Jim had used to have, he's no longer doing, he used to have kind of a modest TV show here at GPH. It was on every night at 7
what
o'clock.
What do you mean modest?
Well, it was, you know, it was not like millions and millions of people tuning in. And, you know, we'd go someplace sometime, some event we had to go to, and people would be coming and say, oh, Jim, you must get that all the time. So I wonder how you handle it. If you're out for dinner with your wife and your kids... or if you're just walking down the street, I mean, is it a pain in the neck or are you okay?
For the most part, 99% of the time, it's just fine. It's kind of like, you know, it really is. It's an honor for people to recognize me, and it's like it's better than that than they don't recognize me, right?
Okay.
But no, early on in like '88, when we just like hit the scene, it was kind of crazy. And I would say at that time it was overwhelming.
Yeah.
Now it's not overwhelming. People are calmer now and they just want to say hello, take a selfie, talk a little bit,
Jordan,
whatever.
What are you talking about? This woman, Jessica, is watching on YouTube. She just saw the photograph. Here's what she posts. Let me hit those short ribs. This is not our normal guest kind of experience here.
So Vance, yeah.
By the way, the short ribs, Vance, let me just tell you, are spectacular.
Yeah, the mushrooms are fantastic, too.
They are really spectacular.
So, were you like a new kids on the block?
Oh, my God.
Guy, being a guy? I mean, I could be wrong. I thought more girls.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, right. And maybe the guys weren't quite so enthused.
I'm going to guess not.
Okay.
We're talking to the two guys, Jordan Knight and Vance Walsh, who have Abbey Park is Vance's, and obviously Novara is reopened after this fire. You're back in business, right?
Yeah, and I also am now part of Abbey Park.
Oh, you are part
of
the Abbey Park? Yeah, yeah. So you're not, is this a restaurant deal? Is this the beginning of more of you involved in the restaurant business, or is this a two-and-done kind of deal?
I mean, I don't have huge aspirations. I like that. I like the group that we have, and it's like they're both in East Milton Square. I like that it's in, you know, my town. So I would say that's about it. You know, I don't have huge aspirations to, let's franchise, let's take over the world. No,
Can you pass me the meatballs or whatever?
Absolutely.
So I think it's fair to say that East Milton Square has gotten much hipper the last few years, huh?
Yes, it has.
Are you from Milton, Vance?
Quincy.
Oh, Quincy. Oh.
Close enough.
Yeah.
Quincy's gotten kind of hip lately, too. I was stunned when I went down there a couple of days ago to go to a restaurant, actually, and the whole place was lit up. Christmas lights. It did have kind of a little bit of a Newbury Street feel. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it really has come along.
Yeah.
Okay, so what is this thing?
Oh, espresso martini.
Oh, my wife loves that.
Wait, this is an espresso martini?
Yeah.
It's like a gallon.
Yeah.
That's right.
Throw it on ice. You'll be happy.
Well, Marjorie's never been happier. So, you know, Jordan, yesterday, Marjorie is obsessed with the monarchy. And yesterday she forced me to discuss Will and Harry, two brothers who are not getting along.
Yeah.
Apparently you get along pretty well with your brother. Mm-hmm. That'd be Jonathan, who happens to be in this band of yours.
Yeah.
Sold only 70 million records, if you're counting. Here he is. This would be Jordan speaking about his older brother, Jonathan, on an episode. Jonathan on an episode of HGTV's Farmhouse Fixer, in which they move and renovate a family home. Here it is.
Is this when I
John
tear?
John has always been the one with the big heart. That's why we get to have these moments together, because of you, you know, because of your. Your heart, you know, your spirit, it pulls us all in and brings us together. And we're so lucky to have you.
You are choking up in that deal. What's that
I was. Well, it's true. My brother is like, you know, he's kind of the heart of the family. Besides my mom. My mom is the heart of the family. I would say he comes in second. But, He is. He just loves us all together. My brother wears his heart on his sleeve, and he has this show on HGTV, and he's asked me a number of times to be in scenes with him and jump in on the show with him. And I guess at that moment, I was feeling just so proud of him, because he's been wanting to do a show like that for a long time. And he just kept pushing and pushing, and he would get an offer, and he said, no, they're trying to sell me short, or I don't like it as much. And he just kept going, and now he has a hit TV show, and I was just really proud of him.
It's like This Old House for Farms, right? I mean, it's a variation on a theme, isn't it?
I would say, yeah, renovating old farmhouses.
What's with the Dorchester kid in farms? I don't quite...
You know
what
is funny? We were like... we lived in Dorchester, but we lived in a big Victorian house. Mm-hmm. And there was a barn attached to, not attached, but on the property. And we had, like, animals, like goats and stuff like that
in Dorchester.
Yeah. We were looked at as a very eccentric family, you know, rightly so, I think. But John was always the one that kind of stayed home and kind of was like, he was like the farm boy in the city. And my parents, they're both from Canada, and... their relatives, and they come from farmland, basically, the farmland in Canada.
We're speaking with Jordan Knight of New Kids on the Block fame and restaurateur Vance Waltz about their recently reopened joint venture Novara in Milton. You know, for people...
Robin says, I think Vance is cute, too. So you're included in this, Vance.
Vance is very cute.
I want to be
Vance.
Clear.
We all noticed that. Vance. Yep. So for people that don't know, tell people how you guys all got together, you and your brother and Donnie Wahlberg, Joey McIntyre, Danny Wood. How this happen when you were like little preteens?
We all went to elementary school together, the Trotter School in Roxbury.
Did you have to wear uniforms then? Did they make you wear the khaki?
No, public school.
Okay, before then. Okay.
Yeah, it was a public school. It is still, I think it's still around. So we all went, we're all from Dorchester. A producer, Maurice Starr from Roxbury, who started New Edition, he wanted to start another group. And he was looking for some young guys who sang and dance. And he first came across Donnie, and Donnie rapped. And he really liked Donnie and Donnie's vibe. And Donnie then, because I used to sing in the school choir, and I sang in my church choir when I was really young. And he just gave me a call and said, you know, this guy Maurice, he wants to start a pop group. And I was like, pop group? He's like, yeah, you know, it's kind of like New Edition. And, you know, I was a big fan of New Edition. And he took me over there to meet him and went up to his house. And he had a couple records that he already had planned for us.
for this new group that he wanted to start, and he wanted me to sing a few lines from the song. So I sang a few lines, and he was like, yeah, great. You're in, kid.
And how old were you?
I was 14.
14?
Yeah, I was 14.
So you went from living in Dorchester in the big Victorian house, mm-hmm. you know, family there, 14 years old, singing in the church choir and the school choir, to, like, international fame in how long?
Yeah. When I was 14, I was more like, I was kind of a street kid. I was, like, break dancing and stuff like that at that time. But, and then it also took us, 4 years to get a hit on the radio. So we were, like, working. We did, like I was telling Vance earlier, we probably performed at the Boston Public Library. We performed everywhere. We performed at my nephew's 2-year-old birthday party. Honest to God, we performed everywhere, and we really made our bones. And we wouldn't say no to an offer. We did it all for free. We just, like, we wanted to get our act together. We put out an album and totally flopped. And then the record label was like, you know, we don't know if we want to keep you guys on, or we should change producers. And our producer was telling us this, and we said, no, Maurice, no. We're doing it with you, doing it together. We did another album, put it out. It was like the first single was almost ready to flop, basically. And then one station in Florida picked it up and called our record company and said, you guys have a hit. You have a hit. This song is blowing up the radio. And then they...
Florida, like, not Boston.
No, in Florida. Yeah, yeah.
No hometown attachment.
Well, we had some
guys?
Love here. WILD, okay. An AM station.
Yep.
So they gave us a lot of love. It was harder to get on Kiss 108, but they helped out a little bit. And
Maddie Siegel was 50 then when that started. By the way, hey, when you're a 14-year-old kid and you're playing, if someone says 40 years from now, you and your buddies from town are going to be playing together, what would you say?
I would say, no way.
What was that like recently? You were apart like more than a decade, right? And then you did this most recent thing, right?
Yeah, we were, we kind of disbanded in 1993 or 4 or something like that. And we got back together in 2008. So we were apart for a while. We always kept in touch, but we were, you know, yeah, we took some time off. And
so how great was that when you were doing it again recently? I mean, that has to feel great, doesn't it?
It was pretty intense. Our first show was in Toronto, Canada, and it was always a big market for us. And we went up on this, like, lift, and we appeared. And all we saw was flashes. And
oh,
it was
God.
Just like, it was overwhelming. It was really intense. And we started off Live Nation. They booked us for 14 shows. That was in 2008, and we've sold maybe, you know, over 2, 3, 4 million tickets since.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So in addition to that, you have a pretty good restaurant. The food is fabulous.
It's fabulous.
I've tasted everything from the mushrooms to the short ribs to the fish. Oh, we didn't taste, before you go, let's taste the dessert really quickly. What is this thing?
Chocolate mousse.
Of course.
Chocolate mousse. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And let me tell you don't know Marjorie well.
Yeah.
This espresso martini gallon here is going to be gone
right.
by tomorrow morning. Trust me, there is no...
It's an Irish slur there, Vance, I would say. Irish slur. Yeah. Okay.
Hey. Jordan, it's great to meet you. Vance, great to meet you. Good luck with the restaurant. We're going to check it out really soon ourselves. Thanks so much.
Thank
and good
you.
Luck
thank
with
you.
Everything.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Thank you very much for being here. We're
thanks,
speaking
everyone.
With Jordan Knight from New Kids on the Block fame and restaurateur Vance Welch about their recently reopened joint venture, Navara and Hilton. And you are here in a little New Kids right now. You've got it, the right stuff from 1988. Thank you very much, you guys, for coming in. Okay, coming up, back to politics, back to the real world. We're going to talk to John King.
We just broke the GBH YouTube channel record ever, by the way.
Okay.
There you go.
John King, coming up next.
Another Dorchester guy,
CNN's chief national correspondent, host of Inside Politics. He's up next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library and streaming on youtube.com/GBH News.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live at the Boston Public Library, streaming at youtube.com/GBH News. Friday, we will not be at the library, even though you can view what we're doing at the library on Friday. We'll be on the Boston Common for the dedication of the memorial to the both the kings, Coretta Scott King and Martin Luther King Jr., as well as 60-plus civil rights leaders from Boston, some of whom were famous, some of whom deserve to be famous, and will be now. That's starting at 11 o'clock right here on 89.7. But continuing with our Dorchester guests, from Jordan Knight to John King, we're joined by CNN's chief national correspondent. He's also host of Inside Politics weekdays at noon. Hello there, John King.
Happy New Year. I was missing last week.
Yeah, you were.
Yeah, we missed you too. We're so glad you're back and following Jordan Knight from Dorchester Guys. He just said, you must have been, well, maybe it's more of a girl thing. I always thought New Kids is more of girls than boys.
I think John's a little older than
New Kids. Yeah, but he could certainly heard of them. But anyway, Jim and I were kind of having a debate before with listeners about how it will play politically. Biden's lawyers finding classified documents in his office when he was that were there when he was doing some work for whatever it was, the University of Pennsylvania down in Washington, something, a locked closet, found it November 2nd. They reported it right away to the National Archives. The archives came and got it November 3rd. But, of course, there is some, not the same, but there is documents in the center of the Mar-a-Lago situation. The government had to subpoena the president many times to get him to give the documents back. It's different, but it's the same. So in some ways. So how does this play politically for Biden?
Well, I think the first and most important questions are the substance. What is the chain of custody of those documents? How did they end up in the former, then, you know, now president, but at that point, former vice president's office? There's nothing wrong if you're a senior official in government and you leave and you have security clearance. Maybe you're going to take a call from a foreign leader. Maybe you're about to take a trip. Maybe you're working on a book. There's nothing wrong. And in fact, it's routine that you ask to see things. To help refresh your memory or to prepare you for a trip or prepare you for a call. But those documents, as we've gone through in the Trump case, were not supposed to stay in Biden's office. They were supposed to be returned. And he is on the record saying it's totally irresponsible. How in the world could this have happened with Donald Trump? So politically, he's going to have to answer for that. Substantively, based on what we know right now, this is A and Z, Biden being A, Trump being Z. Trump proactively had those documents sent to Mar-a-Lago, proactively took them from the White House. Then his lawyers certified they had all been returned, and we know months later they had not all been returned. So these are not the same thing based on the facts we know them now. That does not mean, both on the substance and in the politics, there aren't questions for Joe Biden. Number one, what did he need them for? Our Jamie Gangel reporting that the subjects include documents on the United Kingdom, documents on Iran, and documents about Ukraine. Hold the Ukraine thought. And our justice team also just reporting that the U.S. attorney in Chicago, who Merrick Garland assigned this to, has already sent his preliminary findings back to the Justice Department.
Really?
Wow.
So Garland now has to make a decision, a tough decision anyway, a tougher decision now because of the parallel Trump investigation. Was this an honest mistake? Is the evidence says it was an honest mistake? If so, guess what? Those happen administration after administration after administration, Democrat and Republican. Sometimes people die and their spouse cleaning out the closet finds a document that was supposed to be returned to the government years ago. These things happen. So if the facts are honest mistake, wrong thing to do, but honest mistake, normally you say, you know, you should know better and it gets shut down. We're going to have to see. We're going to have to see. Then you ask politically, Marjorie, sorry to ramble on. Look, Donald Trump doesn't do nuance. Donald Trump doesn't do fact. The mega media silo doesn't do nuance and context and fact. So already you're seeing, see, everybody does it. See, Joe Biden said this was horrible. Democrats said this was horrible when Donald Trump does it. They do it. You can be certain the House Republicans are going to have hearings on this. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that if they do it right. It'll be interesting to see if the Senate Democrats say, you know what, when the time is appropriate, we want to air this out publicly as much as we can. The as much as we can part because of the sensitivity. So this is a gift to Donald Trump politically. They may be very different on the facts. It may be very different on the seriousness, very different on the number of documents and the type of documents. But Donald Trump doesn't care about that. He's going to say Joe Biden does it, too. See?
Yeah. And also, you mentioned Garland in passing there. It seems to me that even though I find him to be a pretty honorable, deliberate soul who does try to separate himself from politics, I refuse to believe that the discussions in the Attorney General's office, regardless of where the facts are, regardless if there is no equivalency whatsoever, don't complicate his job when at least it comes to the Mar-a-Lago portion of a possible indictment. We shall see. You know, John King, I'm really glad you're here for the usual reason. Plus, if I could have called you at midnight on January 6th, I would have, because I can't tell you how much admiration I had for you that night. You were on one of the panels on CNN. Every single time you were called on, without one exception, I believe, you went back to point out what Donald Trump had done on January 6th, 2 years before, as he was making calls 2 years later to try to influence the outcome of that McCarthy vote. For those who weren't up that late, could you share the point you were brilliantly making, in my estimation?
Well, part of it is I was searching, asking my colleagues for help to find the word, Jim, in that I found it eerie. I found it hard to understand, in some ways incomprehensible, in some ways maybe it's a sick way to say it, karma, in that, remember, in that very chamber, 2 years ago on January 6th, which also passed on into January 7th, it was 3:42 a.m. when Mike Pence gaveled the Congress out on January 7th,
right,
when Joe Biden's election was certified. The Republicans didn't go quite that late in their speaker vote, but it also carried past midnight into January 7th. And so in that very chamber where Kevin McCarthy and his two top deputies, by the way, Steve Scalise and Elise Stefanik, and 100-plus other Republicans, even after the insurrection, had tried to block the certification of the election, even after the violence, there was still blood in the chamber when they came back in on the night of January 6th. There was destruction in this sanctuary of American democracy everywhere when they came back into the chamber on January 6th. And Kevin McCarthy was among those who, even after all that destruction, violence against the United States government, violence designed to steal our democracy, Kevin McCarthy helped Donald Trump try, he failed, try to block that election. And there was Donald Trump, Marjorie Taylor Greene playing phone a friend, walking around with her phone, DT visible, handing it to members as Donald Trump tried to say, okay, drop your protest. It's time to make Kevin Speaker of the House. And I don't know the right word for it, but I thought it was important to make clear that these Republicans now run the House. They are, by and large, the same Republicans who tried to help Donald Trump steal the country 2 years ago. I'm all for forgiveness. I'm all for moving on, but they don't acknowledge it still, Jim. They have not said I made a mistake that day. Most of them have not said I made a fundamental mistake that day. I apologize for that mistake. I will never do it again. I will not be lied to by Donald Trump, and I will not believe his lies. Had they said all that, I would have a different perspective on this. It just, we have to look, we have to watch closely anyway when you have a big change in government like this. And I just, again, I can't find the right word for it, but history is going to have a very interesting time 50 years from now with January 6th because of these now two parallel events.
Well, it was really, whatever the word is, it was really important what you did and said, John. So we thank you for that.
So, John, what is going to happen now with this new Congress and the House that is divided? I mean, it's a minority of people that seem to be in the throw it all, burn it all down camp, but they're significant numbers. So what is going to happen in terms of legislation that will affect people?
I think that's a giant and important question, Marjorie. In terms of in legislation that will affect people, I think the odds are virtually nothing. Look, we've had divided government many times in our history. Barack Obama had to deal with it after having, you know, Democratic House and Senate for 2 years. Donald Trump had to deal with it after having a Democratic House and Senate for 2 years. I covered both the Clinton and the Bush White Houses where you had divided government. Sometimes you get actual productive things done when people are forced to talk to each other. God forbid that both ends of the American political spectrum and those in the middle and in between have to sit down and talk to each other about big issues like inflation, like immigration, like child tax credit, like fentanyl. There's a lot to talk about. Will they? Mark me down as skeptical. The House Republicans will launch their investigations and their oversight. And again, there are fair questions about Hunter Biden. There are fair questions about the border. Will they come at it as a performance review and ask about facts? Or will they have their conclusions and then have hearings to highlight the conclusions they've already made, absent facts or with not at least a complete picture? I think if you've watched them in the campaign, you would suspect they're going to do more performance theater than performance review, but we'll see where they go. In terms of legislation, the border is just a great area, Marjorie. Most Republicans come from places, let's say you're Republicans from farm country, the Speaker of the House from Bakersfield, California, Those farmers and small businesses want a guest worker program.
Yeah.
Those farmers and small businessmen have no objection to granting citizenship to the Dreamers. Not everybody, but just to that unique group of the Dreamers. And those farmers and businessmen, like many Democrats and Republicans, would like some more border security. This deal could be done in a minute if the politics allowed it. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch. Does Kevin McCarthy, because of all the concessions he made, he has a narrow majority anyway. It was going to be really hard to do anything of substance anyway, especially anything controversial. Now he's made a lot of concessions to the people who aren't interested in governing, which leads me to believe that things that probably wouldn't happen anyway are probably definitely not going to happen. And that would be reasonable adult conversations and compromise on big issues.
You know, John, I was one of the people who naively suggested when it appeared the logjam would never be resolved that all the Democrats would join with, I don't know, 15, 20 courageous moderate Republicans and pick a non-lunatic Republican as Speaker. And I knew it was preposterous. But let me ask a naive question about the future. When the Republican Party, because of the control that, let's say, the 20 who were opposed to McCarthy throughout most of the balloting, take a contrary stand, refuse to move important legislation, are there vehicles for all the Democrats to join with those same sane, moderate Republicans and do things that the country needs to be done? Or is it too much of a risk for even a moderate Republican to do that kind of thing?
Well, let me deal with the risk part first. The risk part is, Jim, is the reason they have such a tiny majority is because of primaries where a whole lot of Trump-endorsed candidates did not pass the voter test, even in a year that should have gone much better for the Republicans. The American people were not afraid of electing center-right candidates. They would not elect center-crazy candidates. And that's what we saw. The Republicans got a much smaller House majority, and the Democrats actually gained a seat in the Senate. Mm-hmm. So those moderate House Republicans who might be inclined to do business have to think, I'll get primaried. Yeah. I'll get primaried in 2 years. They will come after me in just 2 years, and they'll do to me what they did to some of my friends or the people I thought were going to win and be here to join me in a bigger Republican majority. But are there ways? That's actually a fascinating question, because some of the holdouts in the McCarthy, some of them were just never Kevin people, and they finally came around. Trump's influenced that to a degree. Some of them wanted to negotiate more transparent rules or rules that made the speaker less powerful. They want to be able to pass more amendments and bring amendments to the floor. Well, those rules apply to the Democrats, too. There's also what's called a discharge position. If you can get a majority of members to sign a piece of paper, you can discharge from committee a piece of legislation that the chairman won't hold a hearing on or won't hold a vote on. So I think that's a great question to keep in your back pocket for a month or two from now as we get into the season. If those policy-minded conservatives get frustrated. And the Democrats watching, I know you want to hate all the Republicans. There are good, decent people in both parties who you may disagree with them, but they come here for a reason. And so will they have such frustration in 2 or 3 months that they start looking for those avenues of partnership? There are ways to do it. It's not easy, but there are ways to do it.
You know, we hear in the Massachusetts State House, which is mostly all Democrats, but even before there were so many, it was so lopsided. For 20 years, complaints about having these bills getting rammed through, and the leadership goes into the dark room and comes up with these bills, and they have to, you know, they're pressured to sign on them. Now they want, the Republican lawmakers, to have at least 72 hours to review legislation. That seems like a good idea to me, but maybe it's not because you can't get any agreement. But it does seem kind of crazy.
Because they're not going to honor it. That's another reason.
Well,
right?
But I guess just the pure idea of having time to read a bill before you have to sign the bill seems sort of basic, you know, governing to me.
Look, and that gets lost sometimes. Some of these holdouts just wanted more blood from McCarthy, and many of us thought they were never going to come around, and they did in the end. They did in the end, and he's the speaker, and he pulled it off, and he gets some credit for that. The guy really wanted the job. He allowed himself to be humiliated 15 times.
I guess he sure did.
Before he got it. So we'll see how it goes forward. But I do think these are things to watch as you go down the road. more transparency is not a bad thing. In most cases, especially big spending bills or a bill that's going to change immigration policy or a bill that's going to change education policy, a bill that might change the law of the land to help get tougher on fentanyl and some issues, you know, crime and things. Of course, they should have time to read it. Do you also sometimes have emergencies where you have to do something right away because there's some either national crisis or international crisis? So there has to be an exception to every rule. But some of this stuff, the ability to offer more amendments, the promise that you'll get 72 hours to read at least, you know, 99% of the legislation before you rush it to a vote. Those are good things.
Yeah.
Those are good things. Whether you're a Democrat or Republican or independent, more transparency is a great thing. And so, again, not everything they were holding McCarthy up for is horrible for democracy. So some of it actually might be quite good.
But the reason it doesn't happen is because leadership doesn't want it to happen. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
Leadership understands, especially, look, Nancy Pelosi, these House Republicans are going to do something that the Democrats just did. They're going to pass a lot of bills that they know are going to die in the Senate or get vetoed by Joe Biden. In the Democrats' case, they knew they weren't, you know, Nancy Pelosi's speakership, they just knew Chuck Schumer didn't have 60 votes and they weren't going to go anywhere in the Senate. The Republicans are going to pass a lot of things in the House that they know are going to die in the Senate or that Biden opposes there. But there are other things here where I've said this before. God forbid. The people we elect to Congress, men and women, Democrat, Republican, independent from all over the country, God forbid they actually have to go to the floor of the House or the Senate and vote on things. What a shock, right? That you would propose an amendment and say, hey, Jim, how do you stand on funding for Ukraine? Hey, Marjorie, you know, how do you stand on funding for Ukraine or the earned income tax credit or cracking down on fentanyl? Instead, they cut these big deals. Some of it is to protect members from tough votes because yep. there's a couple of things in the bill that they'll get flack for back home. Oh, well, you wanted the big job. You got to take the big hits.
You know, John, democracy may be in trouble, but pitchers and catchers report in 1 month. So just keep your calendar marked. John King, it's great to see you. And again, congratulations on the other night. You were really an inspiration.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much. Great to see you.
Thank you, John.
CNN.
We've been speaking with CNN Chief National Correspondent John King, who's the host of Inside Politics, which you can see every weekday at noon. And you can see John King a lot on TV all day long on CNN. Okay, coming up, new research shows eating all your calories earlier in the day, which is what we've been doing here for about the last half hour with all this great food, is better for your health. We're going to open the lines and hear from you about why the early bird special is actually good for us and why we can't help but eat a second dinner at 9 p.m., even if we had our first dinner at 5 o'clock. We're going to take your calls and texts at 877-301-897. 877-301-897. You're listening to Boston Public Radio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. We're live at the library, streaming on YouTube.com/GBH News. This Friday, we're broadcasting live from the unveiling of the Embrace statue, the memorial to the kings and other civil rights leaders on Boston Common. We'll be interviewing some of the leaders who will be part of that event from 11 to 1. Then we'll start carrying the ceremony live at 1 till its conclusion on 89.7. And here at the library, we won't be here, but there will be a listening and watch party for our show and the ceremony. No tickets or RSVP required. You know, we all know the mantra to punish ourselves for eating healthy. We are what we eat. But new research shows we might also be when we eat, with studies showing it's beneficial not just for weight, but for chronic disease risk, too, to eat the majority of our calories early in the day. So say what you will about the full English fry-up, but they might be on to something. And those Mediterranean who live in the blue zones in Greece and Italy might need to attribute something other than their 9 p.m. dinner feast to longevity and good health. Do you buy it? Even if you want to eat healthier, is the barrier of the structure of the American workday preventing you from building healthy eating habits, meaning eating more at lunch and breakfast than at dinner? Are you now going to bring an induction cooktop to your desk at work for eggy toast? Or are you saying health be damned and sticking to the indulgence of a midnight fridge feast, two scoops with chocolate sauce? 877-301-8970. Can I cut to the chase here?
Yeah.
By the way, did I say it? Yeah, 877-301-8970. One of the great joys in my life, particularly on stressful days, is knowing the day will end with a great meal. When I was president of my union in New York City, I often worked till 11 or 11:15 at night, just like you did in the journalism trade when you started your work as a journalist. We talked a lot about this off the air. The thing that got me through the day is I knew at 11 o'clock at night, somewhere in New York, I was going to have a peaceful dinner with a drink at the end of the day. So while I am totally convinced reading these studies that it is healthier to eat most of your calories at breakfast or lunch, it is just not in the cards for me, and I think most people like me.
I guess so, but look at all you've eaten here today. You
know, that doesn't count.
What's the name of the restaurant again? I have to go to plug.
Navarro
restaurant in Milton. The food is absolutely fantastic.
Fabulous, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's an issue of when you get hungry, right? If you eat a big meal at 6 o'clock or even 5 o'clock, you're probably not going to be hungry again before you go to bed.
No, you don't. The difference between you and me, there are several differences between you and me. One difference between you and me is you eat for the nutrition. And for the sustenance.
Well, you're hungry.
No, I do not eat when I'm hungry.
Okay.
I eat for the joy of the eating experience. Okay. So there are many a night after like this, for example, where I'm not going to be hungry come dinner time. But it's a thing. It's like when you go to a restaurant, you don't go to just order a meal.
Right.
You go for the whole feel of the damn thing.
Okay.
You're much more practical. And, you know, it's sort of like I need to eat to live kind of thing. You need to eat to have joy in your life, too. So we want to know if, based upon this research, assuming you buy it, and I don't think it can be contravened. I think it's true. If you eat earlier, you're going to live longer. You're going to be healthier in lots of different kinds of ways, not just your weight and your waistline. Is that a behavior that you've either practiced or do practice, or is it a behavior you could switch to? The study, by the way, the field is called chrononutrition. I assume that's because of the clock, the time kind of thing, 877, you seem totally distracted. Are you?
Well, no, I was just looking because they were talking about the Mediterranean diet, you know, how it's more healthy for you. Lots of fruits and vegetables and whole grains and nuts and seeds and all that.
Yeah.
And they were talking about how in Spain, which is famous for having late night
meals.
Eating culture. They said, but people are not eating a big meal late at night, that they have their big lunch midday meal then, and it's huge, and they go out and eat late at night, but it's not very much that they're eating late at night. So I don't know. That makes sense.
Marjorie, one of the few joys in life is to eat late and stuff yourself to the point where you can't walk.
Okay, Jim.
I mean, let's face it. That's what I'm guaranteeing you. The vast majority of our listeners, like, wait for this moment. You know, we have a colleague here. I shouldn't say her name. Zoe.
Okay.
For example, Zoe told us, I thought she was lying today. Do you know what time she eats dinner most days?
Early.
4:30.
4:30 or 5.
What is like the early bird special?
It is your early bird
what
special.
What is going on
that
with her?
That is the way to live longer, to start going to the early bird specials all the time.
Forget
about waiting until 6 o'clock to
live
eat dinner.
Live longer with no joy.
Yeah, 4 I to mean, 6. Well, what's wrong with the early bird special? Less
what do you
crowded?
Do at 6:30? And 8:30.
Well, I maybe you go home and read a book or go home and watch TV.
No, what you do, you have a second dinner. That's what most of us would do if we ate dinner at 4:30. Let's try Sam in Saunders, Rhode Island. We're talking about the health advantages of eating most of your calories earlier in the day. Hello there, Sam. What's up?
Hey, Saunderstown, actually. Yeah, it's Sam Copper here,
former
producer of Live from Scullers. How you doing?
Oh, Sam, it is great to talk to you. Welcome.
Yeah, Live from Scullers. Wow.
Hey.
By the way, I really look forward to the tribute that's going to happen to Eric in another few weeks.
Indeed. Well deserved, by the way. Really well deserved.
Oh. I mean, the word icon is overused, but he was that, and he was
glad you said
a dear man, too. So listen, in the last 10 years, my physiology has changed completely. I used to be able to eat late, coffee 5 minutes before going to bed, drink late, whatever. Last 10 years, leading up to my current 76, everything has changed. And if I eat a full meal and then try to go to bed, you know, shortly thereafter, I'll have the worst night of sleep ever. I gotta put a good 2.5 at least or 3 hours between a reasonable-sized meal and trying to go to bed. And Marjorie was, you know, same thing my sister tells me, who's a regular traveler in Europe. The Europeans do have a late meal, but it's a light meal.
Right.
That's what Marjorie
said.
They
have their bigger meal earlier.
Yeah. So.
Well,
yeah.
I hear you. I'm in the 2.5 class with you. He needs 2.5 hours before he goes to bed. I need 2.5 minutes after, and I know it's uncomfortable, and I know it's not healthy, but it's what I look forward to. Sam, it's really good to hear from you. Thank you very
much.
Now, Zoe explains yes. herself. Could you read what she note she just
I
wrote?
I live in a scenic existence, Jim. It's just Boston Public Radio, dinner at 4:30, no joy, all discipline. So there you go. Certainly that's our fault,
there is
Jim.
There's one honest
that,
woman.
She's in that kind of boat. But I think it's a lot of...
What time do you eat dinner every day?
Well, it depends. When I'm by myself, I might eat earlier. When I'm not by myself, I might eat later because one of the problems with men is that they like to have dinner. And so somebody's got to prepare the dinner. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, but so
and eat the dinner.
So later. You, but basically,
I would have a peanut butter sandwich.
You eat when you decide. I feel hungry. It's
time
for
dinner. I feel
hungry,
and I don't really care that much. And I'll have like a peanut butter.
So why do you ever go to a restaurant?
Because it's fun. It's fun. You go out with your friends, and you go have a cocktail, and you sit and chat. I mean, that's why I go out to a restaurant.
Now, let me tell you.
I mean, I think there are different kind of people, Jim. You know, you're someone who's always been into food.
I'm into food,
as long as I've known
yes.
you. I mean, our previous radio station, Jim would have had a big sub for lunch, like a nice Italian sub for lunch.
Yeah.
And then they announced that there's food down the hallway from Wilson Farms.
Yeah.
And the commercials come. We used to have these long commercials, five, six,
it's
and seven.
Like roller derby
like
going
roller
down the
derby.
Hall.
And you would be leading the roller derby
I would
crowd
be leading
even
the
though
charge.
You just finished your Italian. So you weren't hungry.
Yeah.
But you went and ate anyway because you weren't hungry.
I know why. Marjorie is doing this because, as I said earlier in the show, she's been saying for years my father went to jail. He did not. And what she is trying to do is disparage my late mother. And the reason is because it is true that my mother, every night before I went to bed, we ate fairly substantial dinners.
Mm-hmm.
My mother would make me a Hebrew National salami with
yeah.
an extra slice on top. And when would she give it to me, Marjorie?
Right before you went to bed.
Right before I went
yeah,
to bed.
Which I find unusual.
Every single night.
Which I find yeah. unusual. Did you have to get up and brush your teeth after that or not?
I can't remember. But I know at this day, even before I read these studies, that having a thick Hebrew National salami sandwich 5 minutes before you retire for the evening is probably not an excellent idea.
Okay, listen to this. If I eat at 4:30 p.m., this is a texter, and then eat again at 1 a.m., isn't that just early morning? And you're saying I'm good. And here's somebody else who says, I have to get up very early for work. For years, with rare exceptions, I have not eaten past 3 p.m. I don't know why I started doing this, but it really helps me sleep better.
You know what I just realized? I don't know. You know, you're subscribing to this notion about lighter meals. I eat breakfast and lunch with you almost every day.
Yep.
You have virtually nothing for breakfast, and you have virtually nothing for lunch other than two-thirds of a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. So when do you eat? When do you get your calories?
Well,
thank you. I appreciate that. Okay, Justin in Cambridge.
Oh, somebody says I'm picking on you, Jim.
You are picking on
yep.
me.
I love you guys. Jim, don't let Marjorie pick on you. That's a reversal.
That is a reversal.
They usually say.
It's outrageous.
Justin in Cambridge, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Jim, Marjorie, a bit of a contrarian's viewpoint here. I don't eat in the morning, and it's for motivational purposes.
Why is that?
I'm in sales, yeah. and I if I eat a big meal in the morning, it slows me down.
Me
I can't
too.
Think on my toes.
Me too.
I go straight espresso, a little cafecito until about 2 p.m., and I rock and roll. And then at 2 p.m., I eat a nice lunch, chill out. And then the rest is history. So it's not even an intermittent fast. It's just that my mind works better if I'm a little bit hungry for the day.
I am so with you, and you said it better than I. Justin, thanks for the call.
Justin, hold on for a second. Oh. Do you eat dinner after the nice lunch at 2?
Yeah, but dinner is at 7:30, 8 p.m.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
there he is.
Yeah. So that's not early.
He's like a type A personality kind of. Justin's a go-getter kind of thing.
Yeah, I think it's very difficult for most people to eat early because they don't get home and work in time. Mm-hmm. Even now it's better because some people are working from home. But if you're not working from home, you get out of work at 5:30, 6. You don't get home until 7. You know what I mean? That's how you end up eating later.
We pride ourselves on.
That's why you have a slow cooker, Jim.
That's a very good point. I use slow. You've never used. I've given you 3 slow cookers. You've never opened the box on any of them. You've told me that.
Someone say
you were inebriated one night. You admitted it to me
on the first. First time you gave me the slow cooker.
Well, I didn't know that.
Why do you keep giving
Because I didn't
more?
Know. And so I gave you different size slow cookers for 3 years in a row. By the way, I started to say we try really well to treat our coworkers responsibly. It matters to both of us.
So
what I think we should at least discuss off the air is letting Zoe leave work earlier so she could eat dinner at like 3. And then maybe 3:15. And then just take it from there. Zoe, if that's amenable to you, please send us a note. Chris in a car, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there. She says she's done it.
Hey, guys. How you
surprised.
Doing?
What's up, Chris?
Fine, thanks. Thanks for calling.
Chris in a car, long time, second time.
Thank you.
Anyway, I just wanted to comment on the conversation. During the holidays, there was a restaurant that my wife and I wanted to go to. So we made reservations. Unfortunately, because it was so busy, we could only make reservations for 5 o'clock.
Ugh.
We told the couple we were with. and we got mocked to no end. Good. You know, what are we, octogenarians, old, blah, 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 blah. We got to the restaurant at 5, had some drinks, appetizers, ate. They didn't rush us. We had dessert. We were done at 8:30,
oh.
And our friends said this was the best thing that we ever did. Ate, drank, festivities, 8:30, you're home by 9. So,
yeah, but the problem, Chris, that sounds beautiful, but most restaurants, unfortunately, and I, as you know, I'm a big champion, as is Marjorie, particularly of small independent restaurants, most of them in this economic environment are not crazy about having people sit around for 3.5 hours, you know?
Well, you know what? They didn't rush us. And
that's
it
great.
Wasn't a big restaurant. They didn't rush us. But the point is, even I mock my wife sometimes. But you know what? Like I said, had a great time. And 8:30, we're done. We're home by 9.
Do you want to say the name of the restaurant?
Greenleaf in Milford, New Hampshire.
Fabulous. Greenleaf in Milford treats their customers apparently quite well. Chris, thanks for sharing the info. Appreciate it.
A texter says you're being ridiculous, Jim.
Why?
This person is in the Zoe camp. Dinner at 4:30. I don't crave another meal or even a snack later. There is more, Jim, to life than eating.
No, there is. By the way, there is. But that texter, what's his or her name?
They didn't give their name.
They don't understand. This is not about eating. I've said it 1,000. It's about the experience. Eating is part of the experience. Whether you're doing it at home or you're doing it at a restaurant, as the prior caller did, eating is part of the thing. It is not the whole thing. Do you understand? You don't even get that.
No,
do you, really?
I do. I think like some people are more into food than other people. That's what I think. Some people are more into different things. I mean, we're all different, Jim.
Oh, that's beautiful. That is really a beautiful concept.
I thought that was a profound statement.
That really is. And by the way, can we get back to this other guy who called a few minutes ago and said, when you start, he's the go-getter guy.
Yep.
If I'm stuffed at the beginning of the day, I lose my energy, whatever. You know, because we've been out at a buffet, for example, like a Sunday, which is nothing I like better than a Sunday brunch kind of thing. But you really can't move after. I mean, if you do, have you have the bulk of your calories at the beginning of the day, you literally have to be put in a wheelchair to get to your car.
Well,
you know that to be true.
We went to this very snazzy buffet once with our lawyer.
Bristol Lounge.
And
it was unbelievable.
It was expensive. So you felt like you needed to eat a lot.
Well, he was paying, so it was okay.
He was paying,
actually.
But you felt like you needed to eat a lot to make it worthwhile. Yeah. And I don't think... Dude, that's one of the problems with buffets. Keep going back and keep going back and keep going back. So I think that's the problem. If you just had a regular old breakfast, it wouldn't have been so bad, Jim. Okay, but I think the thing about not being able to think that well is very true. It's hard to think well
when you're stuffed
on a full stomach.
But by the way, they are pretty much saying you should. I mean, if you read the research and you read the executive summaries of the research, they basically are saying, comparatively speaking, you should stuff yourself comparatively earlier in the day.
Listen to this.
What?
This is from Ben and Ipswich. Words to remember. Breakfast like a king, lunch like a prince, dine like a pauper. It's what his mama told him.
Oh, my God.
I think I've heard
that.
Who's
his mother?
Somewhere.
Queen Elizabeth? I mean, what is that about?
But I think I've heard that before.
You have?
Yep. Somebody Jewish said it was a benefit to marry an Italian person because she and or he and the spouse live to eat. You should call them up, Jim.
Well, I have no problem with that. It's one of the great joys of life if done properly, but not done at 4:30 in the afternoon.
Do we have time for one more call?
Reverend Jim. No, we don't. You have 30 seconds, Reverend Jim. Literally 30. Go.
This is a thanks a lot call.
Yeah.
You're talking about healthy food, and my wife's away.
Yeah.
And while she's away, I play.
Yeah.
I was just pulling into Kentucky Fried Chicken to get a dinner. So thanks a lot for the guilt.
Make sure you get extra skin.
So, Reverend Jim, after the Kentucky Fried Chicken lunch, you're going to go back to McDonald's?
Take a nap.
For dinner at 8 o'clock or what?
Going to go buy some cookies.
Oh, going to go buy some cookies.
My kind of guy. Reverend Jim, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Okay, we are done.
We're done.
I want to thank people very much for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. I hope you all enjoyed seeing Jordan Knight on the Zoom because we were live on YouTube. Streaming.
Joey McIntyre will be on tomorrow, by the way, in case anybody's interested.
You can keep up with us 24/7 by way of our podcast. Or you can tune in tomorrow for national security expert Juliet Kayyem, our food policy writer Corby Kummer, GBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen, NPR TV critic Eric Deggans, and a special midweek music segment with the Boston Children's Chorus.
I am
Chorus.
So into
We've
this.
We've heard them before. They are really great, and they're going to play Friday at the special Embrace Dedication.
Yep, they are.
I'm worried about the weather. I hope it clears up.
Well, it's going to happen regardless. It may
happen
inside,
right.
But it'll happen.
We want to thank our crew, Zoe Matthews, Aidan Conley, Mackenzie Farkas. Additional support provided by Brendan Deedy. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. Bill Piacentelli and Brian Bell have been on the board today. And we want to thank as well our executive producer, Jay Bologna, plus our special team at the Boston Public Library, Steve Baracci, Evelyn Brito, and Angelica Marrero.
Good luck with the espresso martini.
I'm very excited about the espresso martini.
Navarro, thank you all for coming.
Thank you,
we appreciate
much
it. Have a great day, and we will talk to you tomorrow.
Yes, we will. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks again for listening, and I hope you can listen tomorrow. Meanwhile, I hope you have a great afternoon.
Bye.